ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Fight Night Picks with your host, Craig
and Matt
Ellis.
And just like that, we're back and getting set for UFC 277. Thank you so much for joining in with Fight Night Picks. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. I'm switching it up, Matt. A lot of people have found us on the social medias, and The reception has been very positive. So thank you. You can find Matt Allen to my left, to your right, at Matt Allen FNP on the respective socials. Matt, watch out for the shadow box case behind you because Butterbean's glove is in there now.
I get concussed about three times a week hitting my head off this thing.
Yeah, nobody realizes it. But we do have a big time show coming up, of course, with a pay-per-view that is scheduled for this weekend. A rematch just over 6 months in the making. Juliana Pena taking on Amanda Nunes for that bantamweight strap. And in the co-main event, it's a rematch for interim flyweight gold. Now, the first fight wasn't for the title, but the first fight was an absolute banger. Brandon Moreno taking on Kai Kara France. This weekend show is going to be coming at us from the American Airlines Center in Dallas, Texas. So a lot of storylines going on there.
Will Luca be in the crowd?
I hope so. Mark Cuban definitely will be. But we have 13 total fights on the card. The prelims are interesting. We have three different debuting fighters, and we have a lot to say about them. We have plenty of ranked contenders as well on this card, but the main card really does take the cake, and we'll be live for that with Fight Night Picks Sidekick here on the channel. You can join in as that pay-per-view is live. We'll be providing commentary. We'll be hitting up the comment section as we do all week, every week, and of course, question mark kicks live 2 hours before the prelims. Matt, 12-2 last weekend, 10-4. It was an absolute wave of success, and I know you're really excited about the card coming up this weekend.
There's a lot of fun fights on this card from top to bottom. I know we're both really excited for Jakar Close versus Rafa Garcia, and I'm really excited for how Jakar Close is going to look from this point on, because he had that really long layoff after the Benil Dariush loss, but he looked great against Bubba Jenkins his last time out. Now,
Bubba Jenkins?
Brandon Jenkins, sorry. But, and I understand, there's levels. Like, Benil Dariush, one of the best lightweights in the division, whereas Jenkins, let's all be honest about where he kind of fits in the organization. But this fight against Rafa Garcia is sort of a straightening of the ship, if you will. Because if Jakar Close is able to beat Rafa Garcia, then I'd say he's pretty much on his pre-injury trajectory. But Rafa Garcia is the type of guy who can make any fight very difficult. So I think that's a fight that's not getting enough credit. But that's the whole thing about this pay-per-view. I feel like not enough people are talking about this card. You have the greatest women's fighter of all time in Amanda Nunes trying to reclaim her belt. That's a pretty big storyline, and good on Juliana Pena too. I'm going to bring this up later, but she's really taken advantage of the fact that she is now UFC champion. She's been able to go on a lot of like mainstream news outlets, which, let's be honest, MMA as a sport doesn't normally get onto, especially now that Anderson Silva, GSP, sort of those mainstream stars have faded. It has been nice to see Pena really be able to get her name out there now that she has become UFC champion.
And a big time opportunity for a lot of these fighters. We're going to throw it on over to our Fight Night Picks Fight of the Night screen. Be sure to let us know down below in the comment section, as you do every single week, who you have on the screen, because there's a lot of fun fights coming up. So we'll throw it on over to the Fight of the Night screen.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
So, on the card this weekend, Fight Night Picks, Flyweights Never Die, Alessandra Pantoja, Ultimate Fighter alum, is going to be taking on an interesting fighter in Alex Perez, probably Dana White's Contender Series biggest, brightest star that you never hear about, because he's had 6 fight bookings fall through since his last fight in November of 2020 when he lost in his title fight against Deiveson Figueiredo. There's never been a Dana White's Contender Series fighter fight for the title other than Alex Perez, so keep that one in the back pocket if you're talking about it with your friends and family, if your family are wild MMA fans. But in this fight, Perez has a wild, come forward, never stop type of style. Alessandra Pantoja, like a Swiss Army knife. I think this is going to be a great fight.
This is a very good fight. It has everything written all over it because both these guys are so well-rounded, even though they kind of do specialize in different areas of mixed martial arts, and that's why it's such a good fight. Either one of these guys could become the champ, or either one of these guys could honestly fit themselves into that co-main event fighting for the interim title. That's how skilled all these flyweights are at the top of the division. But this is my big hot take about Pantoja. If he was 50 pounds heavier and fought in a weight class that more people cared about, and I hate saying that, but it is the truth. If he was a welterweight or a middleweight, he'd be headlining fight night cards like he's Anthony Smith. He is that type of a fighter to where he is must-see TV every time he's in the cage, and hopefully that this is the type of card that can really give both these guys the eyeballs that they deserve, because I do believe that this is the fight people are going to be talking about for not only days, but weeks after the fight's over.
Well, it should be a great one. I mean, the second pick here, Drew Dober's taking on Rafael Alves, and when you look at this fight for Drew Dober, he climbed to the top of the mountain, he fought Islam Makhachev, he got mopped, and then he fought again.
You're really selling this fight well.
And he lost again, but he picked up the pieces because, you look at it, he took on Terrence McKinney in one of those one-round fight of the night type atmosphere fights where both guys get dropped, McKinney got takedowns at the start of the round, and then ultimately Drew Dober was able to win out by the end of it. He's taking on Alves, who is an absolute wild man. I mean, dropped Demiris Magulov at the start of their fight, rallied back in the third round, even though he lost the fight, and then his last time out, picked up a giant win against Mark Jacasey, finished him, and you saw how good Jacasey can be on the ground his last time out. I love this fight.
And when Alves is at his best, he does look to be like a ranked contender. That's how special his skill set is. But we know that Drew Dober is one of the great litmus tests in the UFC. He's someone who will take a beating, but also give out a beating too. And even if you beat somebody like Drew Dober, you're going to take a licking while you're at it. So this is going to be a great fight for both guys. It's a really hard one to predict too, just because both guys are so durable. They both hit so hard. Like, this will be an incredible fight.
Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this fight of the night screen. 13 to choose from, and you're not wrong until Saturday. So throw those down there in the comments, and we'll do our best to get back. So coming up on this weekend's card, you have ranked fighters in Nunes. You have, who else, Matt? I mean, Brandon Moreno, Kai Kara-France, Derek Lewis, Sergey Pavlovich.
Pain, I would hope.
Alessandro Pantoja, Alex Perez, you have a tricky guy in Magomed Ankalaev, Anthony Smith, that equals to 9, and then you also have your champ, that's Juliana Pena. So 9 ranked fighters, the one champion that's out there, 2 belts that are going to be on the line, so to speak, with the interim strap in the co-main event. 3 debuting fighters, we have Ihor Pateria, you also had Adam Forget about it. And then you also have another fighter in the former Egyptian Olympic wrestler Hamdi Abdelwahab. And I think that's an interesting fight that he has coming up against an interesting fighter, I guess, at heavyweight.
A lot of interesting
things
on
this card. Holy smokes, it's Dontel Mays coming in at 6'6", taking on the smaller fighter in Abdelwahab. But Matt, a lot of fights that we can really look forward to. The 3 debuting fighters, that's always exciting. We also have Dana White's Contender Series previews that are coming out on the channel. 1 pick each. They can differ. They can be on different fights, so on and so forth.
They could differ on the same fight.
I mean, my goodness, they're all on the channel. So an extra ad, and that's all thanks to you folks out there, the fans of Fight Night Picks. We reached our 30,000 subscriber goal here. We're throwing that out there to you as the reward. So thanks so much for the support. It's just been a wave of support throughout the summer too. I just want to thank everybody out there. Matt, again, I know we're really looking forward to this card.
It should be a really fun pay-per-view. Again, I do feel like it is somewhat flying under the radar for being a rematch for a title fight that involves one of the greatest athletes of all time. Like, if you just read those words on a piece of paper, you're like, wow, this is one of the biggest pay-per-views of the year. But it does feel like it is going under the radar. I'm really excited for the co-main event, of course, being Brandon Moreno versus Kai Kara-France. Another rematch where, like you said, only a 3-round fight the first time, but we saw how talented both those fighters truly were, so it is nice that we see them both at the top of the rankings this time around, fighting for a very, very fun fight in this belt.
Great opportunity for all those involved, a very, very stacked card that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.
Kicking off the card at UFC 277, we've got a fight at welterweight between Orion Galaxy Kosi, Dana White's Contender Series alum, and boy, did he look good over on the show. He's looking to right the ship. He did lose in his UFC debut, albeit it was a banger. He's going to be taking on City Kickboxing's Blood Diamond. Now, if you go on some sites, they have it as Mike Mathitha. If you go on others, including ours, we're going straight to Blood Diamond. This guy, one of the few, well, the only, representing Zimbabwe in the UFC. Young career in MMA. It's just 3-1. Came into the UFC at 3-0. Took on Jeremiah Wells in his debut. That's not a good debut opponent. He did end up losing that one. But if you do the deep dive on Blood Diamond, he is cut from that same cloth of some of his opponents. You see Israel Adesanya with a big-time kickboxing record over with WLF, or whether it was over with Glory. You look at another guy, and holy smokes, does he look impressive in Carlos Ulberg at 205 pounds. But when it does come down to Blood Diamond's overall career in kickboxing, 52-14 the record, 17 knockouts. His last kickboxing opponent that I could find was 15-15. But that's neither here nor there, because when it comes to Blood Diamond's style inside of the cage, this guy is a very, very dynamic striker from either stance and whether he's moving forwards or backwards.
My big issue with Blood Diamond is, though, and I agree with everything you just said, he got rushed to the UFC far too early.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's a very big issue. And we were talking earlier on the Contender Series show, check it out if you haven't yet, but we were talking about how Bo Nickel's is going to make his debut on week number 3. I fear the same thing might happen to Bo Nickel that has happened with Blood Diamond. And it's a very big injustice that MMA doesn't have a strict amateur ranking system like boxing does. And I bring this up a lot because the great thing about boxing amateurs is it just gets you really good at the technique. It's point fighting. You don't really go for knockouts. You can win by knockouts. Look at Evander Holyfield. But if you're just a really good amateur fighter, you don't take a lot of damage. You get really good at the technique of the sport. And that's a great foundation to have for when you turn professional. The problem with MMA and the whole amateur ranks around MMA is, A, the rules are different. You can't normally throw elbows in MMA or in amateur MMA. And B, MMA, you take a ton of damage in, so you don't really want to waste yourself on the amateur scene and take or get taken down 1,000 times, eat a bunch of unnecessary damage that you don't want to take so that you don't have that as a basis when you get your professional career going. That's the big issue with a lot of these fighters with limited MMA experience, but a wealth of experience in things like kickboxing, straight jiu-jitsu, any one area where they don't really have the ability to flesh out a well-rounded skill set, because Blood Diamond is one of the best pure strikers in the UFC. And I don't think that's a crazy statement. Like, strike for strike, he is as good as anybody. But he's 3-1 in MMA, and let's be honest, at the UFC level against Jeremiah Wells, he did not look great. And Wells was a difficult opponent, don't get me wrong. Like,
not in the first 5 seconds of that fight.
No, his controller died and he walked into the cage. It was very, very strange. Like, the AI wasn't set just right. But still, Wells was able to put an absolute bully beatdown on Blood Diamond as that fight progressed, and that's the issue. Think about Gokhan Saki. Like, Gokhan Saki is one of the greatest kickboxers ever. Of all time. And he wasn't all that great at MMA. You want to know why? Because the skill set isn't directly translatable. That's why I always roll my eyes when Craig will bring up like Wushu Sanda with a guy like Muslim Salikov.
It's going to happen later on in this card with Jeon Kim.
But it's a good thing to have, don't get me wrong. But the issue is, not every aspect of MMA is created equal. Things like wrestling, kickboxing, jiu-jitsu do stand above things like Muay Thai. Well, I guess Muay Thai would be included in the practical ones. But they stand above things like karate, taekwondo, Wushu Sanda. Because those skills aren't directly translatable in a lot of the times to pure MMA. They're good to have as a complement to other things. Look at Robert Whittaker. He has boxing and karate. But my problem is, a lot of these guys who just have a lot of experience in other sports, they just don't really know what they're getting themselves into by the time they get to the UFC level.
Well, and I mean, you look at it for Blood Diamond, his last win was against Dimps Gillies, and this is one that we really focused on getting ready for his fight against Wells. And that fight was 2 years and 4 months ago, so that was his last win in MMA. In that fight, judges scored it 2-29-28, 130-27 for Diamond. When he had the opportunity to strike and he wasn't held up against the cage, he looked great. Again, the stance switches, really, really weird angles on his shots, not the typical MMA combinations, not the typical kicks and so on and so forth that you're used to, that makes a guy like Alex Pereira, a guy like Blood Diamond, a guy like Israel Adesanya so much fun to watch. But the one thing that I did take away from it was he is very left-hand dominant, and that's one of the things the commentary mentioned. So if he's fighting from orthodox, he's going to try and paw out the left hook. When he's fighting from a southpaw stance, he's going to try and throw it straight out, or again, shovel hook, weird angle. But when you look at a guy like Blood Diamond, you consider everything all together, he does have a kickboxing stance when it comes to his striking defense. He holds his hands really low and out, and it's one of those things that you have to worry about. A, it's going to help with the takedown defense. He was able to defend a few of those takedowns from Jeremiah Wells, but ultimately Wells, Daniel Gracie Jiu-Jitsu, able to win out. Matt, we haven't even talked about Orion Cosi. This is a guy, he was a state champ wrestler in California, went to nationals with Hoopa High, and when you do look at it for Cosi, undefeated as an amateur, he did go 3-0 there, 7-0 as a pro, knocking guys dead. Again, there's a lot of different things to look at. He was supposed to take on Nicholas Dalby in his UFC debut, which would have been late last year, ultimately forced out of that fight, some back troubles there. He did an interview on the channel, a little bit of wishy-washy in terms of the recovery process. but it didn't look like it really hampered him in the fight against Phil Rowe. Just seemed like he emptied his gas tank, went balls to the wall, nearly finished Phil Rowe, wasn't able to get it done. Second round, they kind of go tit for tat, strike for strike. Rowe's able to win out, gets a TKO win over Cosi. So they've tried to book this fight quite a few times. This is the third time, so third time's the charm. And when you do look at it for him, Blood Diamond was out of one of the matchups. So ultimately, we do get these two guys. We look at the odds for this one. Cosi opened a minus 150. He's now a minus 172. For Diamond, open plus 130. Now at a plus 146, Matt, we have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us as they are to you. We're in the same room, so there's no cheating here. I haven't seen them. You haven't seen them, I hope. I'm going to say over under 70% Cosi.
I think it'll be over 50, but under 70.
All right, so we're going to have a look. It is slightly under 70. 1,097 total votes, 69% Cosi, 22% by decision. What is that? 54% by submission, 18% by KO or TKO for the 31% that have Diamond, 75% by knockout. Surprise to us that it is to you, but it's not a big surprise to me. And ultimately, when it comes down to this fight, one guy has more skills tailored to MMA. So for that reason, I have him, but I'll let you go.
What's something that ogres and onions both have in common?
Oh boy, layers.
They've got layers. And that's the thing about Orion in this matchup. He has more layers to his MMA game. Again, if he goes into this fight thinking he's just going to outstrike Blood Diamond, terrible game plan, but he is going to lose in a type of fight like that. But the fact that he can go for the offensive takedown and mix his game up is going to be a big factor. I wouldn't even be surprised if we saw an Orion Cosi knockout, because when you are one of these pure kickboxers and you are that worried about the takedown attempt, like you had mentioned, a lot of kickboxers like to put their hands very low in MMA because it helps them anticipate the offensive shot from their opponent. So maybe there is a world where Cosi's able to fake low, go high a la Chad Mendez back in his prime, but I do think Orion's the much safer pick in this matchup for the reasons that we stated. He has the much more well-rounded game. And that's the interesting thing about Blood Diamond. Like, they say you can't teach an old dog new tricks. He is 34 years old and only 3-1 in MMA. So, like, if he doesn't look good now, the time's starting to run out.
Blood Diamond's MMA fights, 2017, 2018 against Huang. In that fight, he submitted him. Huang looked completely lost on the ground. He looked like a lightweight that moved up to welterweight on short notice. Fought in 2020, and then in 2022. He had signed in the UFC quite a ways before he had actually fought. And if you look at it for Cosi, not a good strength of schedule either. These are the records of his opponents as a pro. 1-1, 1-3, 1-0, 4-0. He fought Danny McWilliams, who got finished by Louis Cosi and Orion Cosi and Leon Shabazian and Edmund Shabazian. Danny McWilliams, as I made the joke once
before. He gets brought
before.
Up a lot of Thanksgiving dinners, doesn't he? They're like, hey, remember Danny? We took him out.
The kid got beat off by a brood of brothers in back-to-back sequences. How many Bs can I fit in there? More than Danny McWilliams wow. did with beatings, who was 18-43, and then an opponent who was 2-2. So again, both of us going with Galaxy Cosi in this matchup. Let us know if we're overlooking Mike Mathitha, Blood Diamond, the striker. Or are you going with Galaxy Cosi in this matchup? We have a big-time card set with two title fights up at the top. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Interesting fight coming up this weekend. A battle of Eastern European light heavyweights looking to crack the ranks. And when you look at it, an interesting fight for the UFC debutant out of Ukraine. It's Ihor Poterya. The nickname is the Duelist. That's pretty cool.
It is.
The last fatal Canadian duel was fought in New Maryland, New Brunswick, Canada. I once lived in New Maryland. So there's your Buffalo Wild Wings fact of the week. I'm sure they don't want to hear that. They don't sponsor the show, but heck, take it and run with it. Matt, he's taking on Nikolai Nigamarianu. The nickname is Niku. They call him Nick. They call him Nikolai. I call him one heck of a Romanian specialist in grappling and wrestling, but we haven't even seen in the UFC. It's like he's a completely different fighter. And I know we're really excited about this because light heavyweight needs prospects. Of course, you look at the top half of the division, you have Jiří Prochazka as your champ. Glover Teixeira, is he in? Is he out? He's over 40. Jan Blachowicz later on in his career. But when we do look at this fight, people are going to be excited about Ukraine's Poterya, and I think he does have an interesting potential in the UFC.
He reminds me a bit of like a Jordan Clarkson character, to where if you just watch his highlights, you're like, wow, this guy's one of the best in the league. But then you'll watch him in a game, and you're like, ugh. okay, well, the highs were high, but the lows were also very low. And that's the thing about Ihor. I really do like a lot of these snapshots that you do see from his game. If he was able to just sort of take from some of the best of each one of his performances, then you could make up sort of a weird Voltron of a pretty good fighter. But the thing is, there is an inconsistency to even his performances, and the level of competition, which I know is something you're going to want to talk about later, is a little bit suspect at best. And that's the interesting thing for him. He has never faced a grappler to the level of Negomirianu. But like you said, if you've just watch Negomirianu in the UFC, you probably know him best for his boxing and his overhands and his decent power on the feet, and that's been the really nice thing out of Nick. I wasn't all that sold on him coming into the UFC, even after his first UFC performance against Saberbek Safarov. You guys know how I feel about that man.
Just one point was taken due to fence grabs, but that was the fight where I've never seen so many egregious fence grabs.
It was just a terrible fight, let's call it what it was. But after that, it left a very, very poor taste in your mouth. It was like eating a whole bag of sour Skittles than having that weird mouth the next day where you're like, ugh, that was a terrible idea. I thought Negomirianu was going to be on his way out of the UFC, if I'm being completely transparent, open, and honest. Thought Mason Jones going to beat the brakes off Ludwig Klein. I'm not always right. But what I do like out of Negomirianu is that he is starting to show an aspect of his game that we never really thought we'd ever see the development of. And yes, that could be the sign of a guy not doing what got him to the dance. Think of Johnny Hendricks. Became a top-tier welterweight by combining his wrestling with his striking, and then he fell in love with his striking, and it was never really the same. Also, USADA got implemented. Anyways, he never
no
failed
more IVs.
Test.
That was it.
Exactly. Some rules changed. We'll just say that. But the thing is, I do like the progress we've seen out of Negomirianu. But that's the thing. I thought he was not a UFC caliber fighter whatsoever. And at least up until this point, he's going to offer an interesting test to Ihor with his wrestling and with his striking combination.
So if you look at it for both these guys, the level of competition coming into the UFC, not that great. I'm going to focus on Nikolai Negomirianu first because the overall record of the guys that he beat, he was undefeated, was 37-81. The best win that he had was a first-round TKO doctor stoppage win in 2017 over now PFL heavyweight Hatef Moeli, who I actually consider a really good fighter, and I've said that kind of defending Negomirianu the whole length of it, but Negomirianu was known as this type like Aliaskar Pezriev, where I'm going to ankle-pick a guy in a heavier weight class, throw him around, I'm going to suplex guys. Like, Negomirianu is one of those fighters that if you like a guy like Vitaly Minnikov or, again, the aforementioned Hazriyev,
very athleticism-based.
Yeah, you're really going to like him. He gets it done quick and, again, against poor levels of competition, but still, records are for DJs at some points. Negomirianu comes in on 2 weeks' notice to fight Saberbek Safarov, replacing Gokhan Saki, and he gets beaten that fight. Again, it's not very fun. You don't really get to learn a whole heck of a lot. He takes on Alexa Kammer in his next fight, which is about 2 years after the Safarov fight. Wins by split decision. I thought he won two rounds in that fight fairly convincingly. His next fight out, he knocks out Ike Villanueva, who seemed to get knocked out by many people in the UFC. Sorry, Ike. It's just the way it happened. But then if you look at it for Negomirianu's last time out, he lost to Kenny Inzechiku, but he won by split decision in a fight that, like, he definitely lost that fight.
Well, that's the thing. I would rather him have a close fight with a good fighter than some of the performances I've seen of Ihor, where he just beats the brakes off guys who look like they don't even want to be in there with him.
So, Ihor, I say I'm very excited about him. He fought a guy who is now a champ with Babylon MMA at light heavyweight in Lukasz Sudlowski. And when you watch that fight, kind of the preamble on it is the fact that Ihor is an international master of sport in combo sambo, way to go, Craig, combat sambo, as well as pancration. So both good bases to have, for sure. Combat sambo, huge in MMA, huge portion, very similar to the sport. You go down through it, I mean, he's 20-2, he's on a 17 fight win streak. That's definitely important. And then I started to watch some of these fights. I mean, Ihor has a very sideways type of striking. He is a southpaw. He leaves his lead leg way out there, leans back quite a bit, and then he just throws hooks to close the distance and really get busy.
And that's what I don't like about him. When you look at him from a long distance, he does seem to have decent movement. But then the second he decides to do anything offensively, he squares himself back up and kind of eliminates all the positives that he has set up for himself. That's the problem I do have with Ihor Pateria in this matchup. I just have no idea what we're going to get in the UFC. Like, there's a fighter there who could win this by first first round knockout, and we could have like an Uros Medic on our hands, where it's like, hey, the record looks good, look how good the debut was, like maybe this is an entertaining fighter. There's another world though where he gets dropped by Nega Mariano by the first overhand he throws, and then just gets convincingly out-wrestled for the next 14 minutes.
Well, if you look at it for the duelist, he used to fight a lot and he hasn't fought as much, and obviously that's kind of a tale of the pandemic as well, but if you look at his overall record,
a lot about living and a little bit of love.
20-2, 14 first round finishes from 2017 to 2021. If you look at it, he fought 5 times in 2017, 8 times in 2018, twice in 2019, twice in 2020, 3 times in 2021. And Dana White's big takeaway after he'd beaten Sadlowski over on Contender Series was, well, Ihor was a 3-1 underdog. Okay, Dana, again, that's not how odds work. If one guy's minus 300 and you're plus 175, you're not a 3-1 underdog. You're a plus 175 underdog. The other guy was a 3-1 favorite. But I went through and I looked at it. The last three opponents that Poteria had, their combined records was 24-7. That's very respectable. Sadlowski, over on Contender Series, very good fighter. The other 17 wins, 53-76. And again, the finishes. Majority of Poteria's fights were with WWFC, and you recognize that organization. I mean, Roman Dolidze's coming through there, Denis Bondar, who unfortunately lost due to his arm breaking against Malcolm Gordon. Those are some of the names that I came up with. Also, Sergei Spivak. If you go and watch Poteria's fight coming into Dana White's Contender Series, the strangest dancing I've ever seen in my life. It looked like Mickey Rourke from Iron Man 2. I don't know what those women were swinging.
It was like she had an octopus attached to her head. It was very weird.
It was gross. And straight up, I go back through and I watch some of these fights. I'll give you an example. So WWFC 19, the last two opponents he fought were both from Georgia and both named Georgie. So again, take that one to the
bank.
Is
that like being named Matt in Canada? Like I meet 10 Matts every group I ever enter.
But the last guy that he fought, Georgie Kubajashvili, was 5-2 at the time that Ihor fought him. He's now 5-8. So he's lost 6 straight fights. He was billed as being 29 years old. He looked like Blagoy Ivanov's older brother. He was the oldest looking 29-year-old I've ever seen. And in that fight, he drops slash slips Poteria with a right cross. So Poteria looks completely caught off guard that he's off on his back. And then from there, he ends up sinking up a wicked triangle choke off his back. But I didn't really like that. I know I sound like I'm ragging on the guy. Okay, great finish. WWFC 18, the other Georgie, where the dancing happened. In that one, good double underhooks. And you can see that in a lot of these clinch situations, whether it's gone for by his opponent or he goes for it. Great double underhooks. Doesn't do anything with it. Just waits. He keeps his back to the cage. He has double underhooks. He can't buck them off. It's just a bit of a stalemate. And a lot of positions I've seen Ihor in, once he gets up into top control, are we going for ground and pound? Are we going for the submission? It's just, I love his striking because it's wild. It's unorthodox. It's full of power. Nega Marianu's cut from the same cloth. Both guys had poor level of competition. Nega Marianu's 3-1 in the UFC. Poteria is, I guess, the more unproven commodity, though he has twice as many fights. So you look at the odds in this one. Nega Mariano open a plus 170, plus 120 right now. For Poteria, open a minus 200, minus 142. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us there, to you. A lot of people are excited about Ihor Poteria. I know that. So I'm going to say over under 70% for the duelist.
Under. I think Nega Mariano will be the favorite.
Nope. 1,085 total votes, 69% Poteria, 20% by decision, 70% by knockout. For the 31% that have Nega Mariano, 70% by decision, and 18% by KO TKO. Poteria closes distance quicker, throws hooks, they both do. I think somebody's going to get finished in this fight, it's just a matter of who.
Here's my problem. I'm not going to pick Ihor until I see him do it at the UFC level because I'm just not completely sold on his skill set up until this point. You can look really good on the regional scene where he's been, but the problem is when you're fighting guys who allow you to look really good, then yes, you're going to have a great highlight reel. I think Nega Mariano can make this fight extremely boring, and I think that's the type of fight that he knows how to win. It's like Bernard Hopkins once he got old. He was the executioner when he was young. Then he fought Roy Jones Jr., got destroyed, and then he got smart. Well, he also got really dirty, but still. And he just clinched everybody and got really boring near that stage of his career, but those are the types of fights that he learned how to win. I think Nega Mariano knows how to win those types of fights, and like what you brought up about Poteria's clinch work, I saw that too in a lot of his matchups where that's a position that he looks at as like a stalling position, a place where he can get his breath back. I think Nega Mariano is going to use that to his disadvantage. He's going to be able to use some of that clinch work, but actually use it offensively. So I do think Nega Mariano is going to show us a side of his grappling that we haven't fully seen in the UFC up until this point, and I think this is a good opponent to show it to.
Some big gyms going up up against it, and when it comes down to this matchup, both of us going with Romania's Nicolae Negomirianu to get the win. It should be a great fight. The fans have Pateria at this point. He's also the favorite, so are we absolutely wild going with the underdog here? I know you'll let us know down below in the comments section. We have 13 total fights on this card. Two title fights up at the top that you're not going to want to miss. Keep locked in with Fight Name Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
A fight that feels like it could end up like a Spud Webb dunk in the last 30 seconds when you're trying to make the pick, but it isn't quite so. We have Joslyn Edwards coming in on 2 weeks' notice, replacing Maria Agapova to take on Firefish Ji-Yun Kim from 145 pounds to 125 pounds. Matt, for Joslyn Edwards, and the reason why I say it feels like a slam dunk, if the weight didn't matter, if this is a bantamweight, if this was, heaven forbid, at featherweight, Joslyn Edwards wins this fight.
I agree.
Like, easily, 100%, it's a slam dunk. She talked about moving down to flyweight before she fought Ramona Pascual in a fight that I assumed was going to be a bantamweight. Everybody said it was a bantamweight, except for one obscure interview that was in Spanish, and I listened to it, and it was translated. And so through that, I gained an understanding that, no, it's actually going to be a featherweight. But the second part of it was, Joslyn talked a lot about moving down to 125. And she has experience at 125, although less so than at 135. She has one fight at flyweight. And I'm going to read you the record of the fighter that she took on that was back then. It was 0-0. Like, she wasn't really fighting a great fighter the last time that she fought at flyweight. But again, on 2 weeks' notice, she's talked about making the weight cut down in the past. We're going to have to see how it affects her, but I'm just eager to see what version of Joslyn Edwards we get, because the best version is a heck of a kickboxer.
It is.
That looked amazing against Ramona Pascual. Defended the takedowns. Like, that surprised the hell out of me up at 145, and she was marching her down and landing with great volume, accuracy, and power.
She did, and I did the Jeff Hardy dance for a reason, though, because everybody knows what I talk about when I bring up Jeff Hardy.
Swanton Bomb.
That fateful night in 2009. I remember it like it was yesterday. SmackDown, a steel cage, CM Punk, loser goes home. Let's call this what it is. Ji-Yun Kim needs a win like few others in life do.
She won her last fight against Priscilla Cachuera. The judges robbed her.
Sure, but you better win against Priscilla Cachuera if you want to be a UFC-level fighter. This is my issue. Joslyn Edwards, I do agree with everything that you said. I think she's the much better fighter on the feet, because the problem with Ji-Yun Kim is she moves a lot, but it's not always positive movement. There's like a net negative to it. The only time I've ever seen this stat get brought up during a UFC fight was when Alexander Gustafsson fought Daniel Cormier. I don't remember why, but for some reason, they attract the amount of movement that both guys did throughout the fight, and Gustafsson's was almost like at a kilometer, because he was always the back foot circling around the cage, trying to use the jab and keep DC away from him. Whereas Daniel Cormier had walked like 30 feet the whole fight. It's just him taking left and right steps, trying to corner Gustafsson off. That's a case of somebody probably moving a little bit too much if you're reaching that level. But the point is, with Ji-Yun Kim, it's really hard for her to put a lot of power onto her shots because her feet are never set. And that's going to be a big issue in this fight against Joslyn Edwards, because if Kim can't get the respect of Edwards on the feet with some type of a strike, I don't really see there being a world where Edwards can't just walk her down, use some of those prodding kicks, use some of the knees at the middle too when Kim does close the distance, because Edwards did show a more developed skill set her last time out against Ramona Pascual. But that also has to be said. Pascual's not the greatest fighter of all time. It was a weird fight in a weird division. Let's just call it what it was. But Edwards at least demonstrated an improved skill set, which is much more than we could say her last two fights leading into that. Like, I was not sold on Joslyn Edwards whatsoever, and I thought I was sold a false bill of goods upon her entry to the UFC, because I was really excited for the prospect that could have been when she first signed with the organization. But after a few shaky performances, I wasn't really sure what we were going to get out of her. But she was able to answer a lot of those questions her last time out, which was nice to see.
Yeah, and for Edwards, and I gotta recant for a second, she has the one fight at flyweight. It was against 0-1 Trisha Cicero. She won that fight by unanimous decision. So not 0-0.
That's the name of a jester in the game Skyrim, fun fact.
0-1 Cicero. But when you do look at it for Joslyn Edwards, she does have the knockouts on the way in. She has the fight against Wu Yanan. She wins that fight. She loses to Carol Hosa and Jessica Rose Clark. XMMA commentary's own Jessica Rose Clark. Don't call her Jess. You gotta call her Jessie. That was awkward.
For an Ian Heinisch?
But yeah, that was something. I like XMMA. But when it does come down to Joslyn Edwards, she did show us that added. She had a good gas tank. I mean, round by round, she landed more strikes. 48 in the first round, significant strikes. In the second round, she landed 51. In the third, 65. The percentages were kind of all over the place. But I do like to see that. But for Ji-Yun Kim, we kind of haven't talked about it. We glossed over it. In the UFC, 3-5 is the overall record. Her last wins over Matt's favorite UFC fighter, Nadia Kassem. It didn't go well for poor Nadia. But she's on a 3-fight losing streak. And I look at the losses, the last two. Molly McCann, they go tit for tat. Molly has a couple of takedowns. It's a fight of the night. Molly wins it. Fight of the night against Priscilla Cachoeira. Judges, Bell, Bird, Sal D'Amato. Round one, round three, Cachoeira. MMA decisions, 130-27 Kim. 13-29-28 Kim. 1-29-28 Cachoeira. And that was the fight where they give Cachoeira the belt. She cries. She gives her Oscar speech. And we move on to the next fight. And it was forgettable. But it was a fight of the night. Virginia Kim, though, this is the thing that I always go back to. Black belt in Wushu. Third degree black belt in Hapkido. Black belt, BJJ brown belt. She has all these disciplines. But when I watch her fight, some kicks, a good boxer, good volume, a lot of movement. That's pretty much it.
And that's the thing. Like, this is my big point. I know we get ticked off at each other over it, but you can read a lot of these fighters have multiple world championships in these different aspects. Then you watch them fight in MMA, and you're like, oh, really? We don't really see any of those translate. Jihyun Kim is the ultimate, she just doesn't equal the sum of her parts, and it is unfortunate. It would be nice if we could see the version of her that puts it all together, like we saw Gilbert Burns be able to do when he went on his run at 170. The problem is, she hasn't really shown any evolution throughout a UFC game. It's just been a lot of the same, and it's been dependent on her opponent being matched up with her. Now, I do think Jocelyn Edwards does a lot of the same stuff Jihyun Kim does, but she is just a little bit turned up with her sliders, and that's why I do like Jocelyn Edwards in this matchup. If she can keep it at long range, there really is an answer from Kim to deal with the kicks of Jocelyn Edwards being the much bigger woman and being the much more powerful striker too, especially on the outside.
The two X factors, if you're going to take anything away from this, don't touch this fight, because Jocelyn Edwards dropping 20 pounds on 2 weeks' notice, going from featherweight to flyweight.
She's not Jessica Andrade.
She has one fight at flyweight in her career, so don't do it. Like, I don't care how tantalizing it might be. Jihyun Kim's been training for Maria Agapova, a grappler. She's been training at Bangtao Muay Thai with the Hickman brothers, Loma Lookmanmi, and Zhang Wei Li. She hasn't been at Syndicate for this camp. That's a giant plus. Jocelyn Edwards, the talk before last fight against Pascual a month ago was the fact that she's going with the traveling Shevchenko sisters and Pavel, and that's been Jocelyn Edwards' game plan. It hasn't been with Kings MMA. It's been with the Shevchenko. She's in Vegas training at the PI for this one. So when I look at the odds, again, Kim open to minus 150, plus 109 right now. Edwards open to plus 130, minus 132. We have a look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprised us it is to you, but I'm assuming Jocelyn Edwards is a pretty big favorite. I'm going to say over under 80% Edwards.
I'll say under, but she'll be the favorite.
Son of a gun. 1,002 total votes, 75% Edwards, 89% by decision. For the 25% that have Kim, 87% by decision. She being Jihyun Kim, had a great fight against Molly McCann. It was back and forth. At the end of it, everybody felt good. She had a good fight against Cachoeira. I thought she won. Cachoeira's not this big volume striker,
she's
though.
She's got to get close, too.
And she's a boxer that has to be close to do anything. Jocelyn Edwards does it from range. Her boxing's good. Her kicks are good. So I favor Jocelyn Edwards on a full camp, making weight, looking good doing it. But I can't guarantee you those things are going to happen because I haven't seen it. So to pitch Jocelyn Edwards out of Panama. But again, don't touch this fight for all of the reasons I mentioned. You don't take a fighter that's dropping 20 pounds on 2 weeks' notice.
No, and I like that final breakdown from you. I do like Jocelyn Edwards in this matchup quite a bit. But again, it's going to come down to how she looks on weigh-in day. Let's say she weighs in at exactly on point, like championship weight. They'll be a lot more confident with her going into the weekend. But it's all going to depend on that fight. But good news, Craig, we do have this little-known show called Question Mark Kicks that allows us to change any pick in case we do have some second guesses based off of the weigh-in. So for right now, it's Jocelyn Edwards, but I'm a little bit on the fence, I'm not going to lie.
Well, let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Will it be Edwards out of Panama? Will it be South Korea's Firefish, Jihyun Kim? 13 total fights on the card, 2 titles up at the top. You are not going to want to miss it, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Originally about to be determined between dueling welterweight grapplers Ramiz Brahimi and Ecuador's Michael Morales. Unfortunately, Brahimi out of the matchup. So coming in on 9 days' notice, we have the former X1 World Events welterweight champ, Adam Fugate. And Fugate, you will not forget, and I'm sure you're going to hear terrible jokes like that all week from everybody, but when you do look at it for Fugate, he did take on a very, very decorated fighter his last time out 4 months ago in Solomon Renfro. And in that fight, if you go back and watch the entire LFA event, it's very Renfro heavy. Right before the fight, giant Renfro promo. He is a giant favorite to win that fight. And Fugate knocks him out. And it was a big time win for Fugate because he had spent about almost two and a half years on the shelf. And as I had mentioned, former X1 World Events welterweight champ. You go back, you look at the camp that he's coming out of, Art of War MMA and Fitness. He's a Eugene, Oregon product. You know Oregon for such fighters as one Westland, Oregon's own Chael Sonnen. But when I went through all of it, I mean, listen, he threw 9 straight leg kicks in a row against Renfro because... leg kick, well, he threw his leg out there. They were mostly to the head. Threw a couple of leg kicks. And then as Renfro walks in, it's just a quick right hook KO that drops him out cold. So good win for Fugate. Coming in on 9 days notice. Build is a bit of a grappler. He does have strong takedowns. And if you go back and watch a lot of his fights, he's trying to close the distance. He's huge for this division. Like, he really is. He does seem very big, fighting shorter guys. So he does have to crouch quite a bit. But when he closes that distance... really strong in on his takedowns, and you like to see that. Strong, imposes well on the ground, very good submission abilities out of Fugate, and a good opportunity for a guy at 33 years old to get his foot in the door with UFC here this weekend.
And that's what this fight feels like to me. It's, hey, Fugate, if you win, okay, it springboards you up the rankings quite a ways because you beat a prospect with a ton of promise. Here's the problem. You're fighting a prospect with a ton of promise. And Michael Morales isn't just one of these prospects who they come on in the scene, you have no idea who they are. Like, we were both really excited for him coming on when he was fighting Trevin Giles. And that's the thing. Guys who fight Trevin Giles in their debut are normally thought of quite highly, not only by the UFC, but by fans as well.
Remember when Dricus du Plessis beat Trevin Giles? Off to the races!
Exactly, and Michael Morales made him look not like an amateur, but he did not make him look like the Trevin Giles we're normally used to seeing in the UFC octagon. He beat him up at range, he had really nice boxing combinations. Like, Morales really showed the full toolkit of his potential in his UFC debut, and that was a great thing to see because I do feel like it gives the more casual audience a great platform to be like, okay, we know what we're going to get from Morales, and that's the tough thing for if you get in this matchup. Like, I don't know how much success he's going to have on the feet. Like you said, he does have very good takedowns. He's extremely explosive, and he is able to get into boxing range. He's good at disguising his takedowns with some of his combinations. But I don't know how much respect Morales is going to have for the striking of Fugate. Now, you can look at that two different ways. Fugate had his last opponent do that, and he knocked him out in a beautiful way. But the problem is, Morales is such a good counter-striker. He has great hip movements and base movements on the feet, and that's something that he uses to great effect. He's someone who can slip and rip with his shots. He really does like that fade counter pull too. It's just... Morales has a much more advanced skill set than you would think from a guy who's only 23 years old and 13-0, and I'd be really curious to ask him this too. Just, there's not a lot of fighters from Ecuador in the UFC, and do you think, like, Marlon Vera is, you know, somewhat responsible for this? Like, this is a young guy who probably didn't grow up having a lot of guys in his home country, having success in the sport, then all of a sudden Marlon Vera comes to the UFC, has a ton of success, becomes really almost like a national hero down there. I'd be really curious to see if Morales did sort of view the career of Marlon Vera and be like, okay, that's something I can aspire to in the future.
Yeah, and I mean, when you do look at this card, there's a few different fighters that are going to be coming up. There's also one that's featured on Dana White's Contender Series, if you're tuning in this week, or if it's already happened, in one of the Luna brothers that trains at Entram Gym. And you look at it for Morales, there's pictures with all of these guys from Ecuador really rising up a long time ago with Marlon Vera. But for a guy like Morales training out of Entram Gym, working a striking, because he's a 3-time national wrestling champ out of Ecuador. He's also a Muay Thai champion as well in his native, Southern American country. So when you do look at it for Morales, he was an underdog coming on Dana White's Contender Series against Nikolai Verentetnikov, a guy who was featured on Dana White's looking for a fight, but they said he's too old, but then he's got a fight on Contender Series.
He was pretty good, though.
And Morales did a great job in that fight, taking him down, pouring the pressure on. In his fight against Trevin Giles, you saw that. He was able to finish him in that one. And for Fugate, he was a +350 underdog his last time out against Solomon Renfro that, if you know, I know it's a Dana White saying, but if you know, you know. But if you look at it for Fugate, a great win there. But a couple more things. Both guys have great kicks. Fugate doesn't really disguise it. He just throws a left high kick from an open stance.
He loads up too.
Michael Morales can throw it to all different levels. The one thing I worry about, Morales is a really explosive striker. So again, Dricus du Plessis, I'm going all the way across the cage and throwing everything into it. Morales will go into it, but he does keep his head back a little bit more, whereas Dricus does the peekaboo, I'm coming forward, no more peekaboo, we're going balls to the wall. For Morales too, the other thing, very high guard out of him. which I like when he's taking on a guy like Fugate, who throws a lot of kicks that are coming up high, maybe block those off the arms, however it works. But I think it's an interesting matchup stylistically. Not really surprised by the odds writing them down just before this. So Morales open minus 500, minus 597 right now. Fugate open plus 385, plus 410. But he did that his last time out, and he was able to get the win. So we have a look at the predictions over on Tapology.
Just what I will say, though, just before we get to those numbers. We often say, oh, I like this fighter, but not for these odds. I completely understand why these are the way that they are.
Yeah, I gotta be completely
You know what I mean? It's just like, normally when there's a guy who's a minus 620, it's like, okay, don't touch him with a 20-foot pole. And again, for me, it's too rich for my blood. I just feel like the odds are a little bit juice. MMA is a crazy sport. Anything can happen with 4-ounce gloves. But like, Morales is so good in every single area, and he does really seem to have one of those skill sets that it complements itself, and that's a really important thing for a guy who's only 23 years old to have.
Yeah, even in his last fight, Trevin Giles was able to defend a number of those takedowns. Really wasn't the story of the fight, but if you look at Morales on the regional scene, he's fighting guys that, yeah, not really the best, blown up lightweights up at welterweight, not the best level of competition, but he's beating them in convincing fashion. And even in the Veretetnikov fight over on Contender Series, he suplexes them near the end of that fight, so you know he's there for the three rounds. I do like to see that out of the younger guy. We talked about both these guys. The odds, again, are what they are. We look at the Tapology votes. Surprise us, they are to you. I'm gonna say over under 95% Morales.
I'll say slightly under, but he'll be the favorite.
Oh boy, 908 total votes, 95% Morales, 78% by knockout for the 5% that a few get, 17% by submission, 29% by knockout, 29% by decision. You're going from Ramiz Brahimi of LFA fame to Adam Fugate, now of LFA fame. It's a tough ask. I mean, Fugate, again, had the almost 2.5 years, 2 years, 3 months, 9 days off between his Renfro fight and the fight that he had before that against a man they called Devin Brock, who was 4-2. Took him down, finished him on the mat, TKO due to ground and pound. But again, for Fugate, before that fight even, we're taking on 3-2 Reno Romiglio. And then before that, we're taking on 9-10 Jonathan Vicente. The loss before that, Kalen Hill, who was on Contender Series, who was an interesting middleweight. That's one other X factor for Fugate. Does have a little bit of experience, couple fights at middleweight. He is a bigger guy at welterweight, as I mentioned, to start this one off. But I think the skills and everything that goes with them belong to Ecuador's Morales in this matchup.
This is what I want to see, and I want to get your opinion on this. We saw a great fight at last pay-per-view between Robbie Lawler and Brian Barberena. I want to see a retirement fight for Robbie Lawler between him and Michael Morales. Now, I seem like a 6'6 sadist by asking for that, but still, if you want to build an Ecuadorian star, and if you want to give an aging vet one of those classic send-offs that the UFC likes to do...
Marlon Vera had to fight Frankie Edgar, right?
That's what I mean. I have no joy or pleasure in saying this, but I could see that being a potential matchup in the future, trying to build the name of Morales quickly.
I think it's going to be fun. Fugate has decent takedowns. He has a lot of power on them. He's very much submission over position, though, which I think could get him caught, because he's like to go neon belly and then try and go for a submission.
It's a tough fight.
Both of us going with Ecuador's Morales to get the win. Let us know down below, are you from Art of War MMA, friend, family, or a member of the Pacific Northwest? Are you picking Fugate to win? Are you going with Morales? We have 13 fights on the card. 2 title fights up at the top. You're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Jerkar Close came back after over 2 years away here recently in 2022 and beat the brakes off Brandon Jenkins. He's going to be taking on gifted Rafa Garcia, looking to spoil a 2-fight win streak from the fighter out of Mexico. And if you do look at it for Rafa Garcia, he's taking this fight on just 16 days notice, replacing Diego Fajeya. So when it does come down to this one, it is an interesting fight. When you look at it for Garcia, he's a part of the champ camp. He's up there in Colorado. He's at Ruka Sport as well in California. He trains with Cub Swanson as a primary training partner, but when he's at the champ camp, it's with Justin Gaethje, it's with Archie Colgan, it's with Kamaru Usman. So he is in fight ready shape, and I know I haven't mentioned fight ready as a gym that Jerkar Close has spent time at, but also at the MMA Lab. And Matt, I think a lot of the focus of this video has to be spent on Jerkar Close, because in the UFC he's only lost to pretty damn good fighters, and he's also beaten some fighters, and he has been ranked in the past as well. And if you do look at, or at least fought ranked competition in the past, I should say, obviously that loss to Beneil Dariush is the glaring one. that was a wicked, wicked contest.
It was, and what I really like about Drakkar Klose is he's a steady fighter for the most part. He never fights like he's not Drakkar Klose, and that's a really important attribute to have in this lightweight division specifically, because everybody's so good at everything. If you start to fight unlike your natural tendencies would suggest that you should, that's when you start to run into problems. But for Drakkar Klose, if he was ever going to make a big change to his game, it was probably going to be a long layoff after his biggest marquee loss. And guess what? He came back and looked awesome his last time out against Brandon Jenkins. And I know Jenkins isn't the best guy to ever come over to the UFC, but that was a good fight for Drakkar Klose. I often go at the UFC for not giving guys sort of warm-up fights, but that felt like a great warm-up fight for Drakkar Klose because we all knew how talented he was before that loss. We all saw the promise that he had in the Benil Dariush fight because, like you said, that was a wild back-and-forth fight before Benil was able to get that knockout win in the second round. But Drakkar Klose came back and looked like the exact same fighter he was before the injuries. That was really nice to see, because I know I was very concerned about, okay, what version of Klose are we going to get in this matchup? But I do feel like he's at least back on a similar path to what he was on before those injuries. And that's the neat thing about Drakkar Klose. He was kind of the 16th best fighter in the division, if you will. If you beat him, you're probably a ranked fighter, or you're about to be a ranked fighter. And if you lose to him, you can still be a really good unranked fighter, but still, you sort of know your place with Drakkar Klose in the division. I still think that there's a world where he could get ranked. I do think that highly of him. The only issue I've always had with Drakkar Klose is he's someone who is steady, but the steadiness can almost be a detriment to him sometimes. I go back to that David Tamor fight where he's almost trying to egg Tamor on because he just can't get to him. His feet aren't necessarily as fast as his hands are, and he can find himself behind some fighters who have very dynamic footwork on the feet, and that's something that Drakkar Klose, I think, is always going to run into just by way of his style. He has very good boxing, though, and he's someone who makes use of his shots when he does throw them, and that's what I really like out of Drakkar Klose, and that's why I think this is another really interesting fight, because, okay, you beat Brandon Jenkins. Let's say he's sort of at the lower end of what Drakkar Klose is capable of.
Minus 630 favorite was close in that match.
Exactly. And now Rafa Garcia, a much more dangerous fighter, a guy who himself is trying to get into the rankings. I think this is perfect matchmaking. Like, I'm surprised the UFC has taken this good care of Drakkar Klose with him coming back off that loss to Benil Dariush, because they really have been building him up in a sound way ever since that matchup.
And if you look at it for Drakkar Klose, his base is wrestling. I mean, offensively, defensively, it's definitely a big part of his game. Maybe not so much on the numbers as a Rafa Garcia, but he was a state champ at South Haven High, so we'll give him that. But when I do look at it, I mean, for Klose, when he throws leg kicks, he makes them count. Does he check his leg kicks all that often?
Not at all. And that's the weird thing. Like, there's some fighters who are really good grapplers. Like, I talked about Nikita Krylov last week, and you got a big eye roll. Like, Nikita Krylov is the most frustrating grappler in the world, because in some positions, he looks dominant. In other positions, he looks like a fish out of water, and it's like Drakkar Klose with his leg kicks. Great offensively, but poor defensively.
So when I do look at it, we talked a lot about Drakkar Klose. For gifted Rafa Garcia, he did make it to the top of the heap over with Kambate. I sung his praises when he came in on really short notice, and he took on, and I want to make sure I get it right, 4 days notice to take on Nasrat Hakprost. Couldn't close the distance, got pieced up at range from the boxing. So maybe you like that out of Hakprost, you like that out of Drakkar Klose. That's why you're going with Drakkar Klose. I can't fault you for that one. But if you do look at it, Rafa Garcia was brought up the right way with Kambate. So Campbell McLaren's very polarizing. But with Rafa Garcia, I love what happened. And obviously with Garcia, he always had that great base around him with the training partners and so on and so forth. But when I talk about him having the good lineage, he beat Efrain Escudero. He beat Humberto Bandanai by decision. You like that. You like the steadiness of Garcia on the feet. When he fought Chris Gritzmacher, I thought he 10-8'd him in the first round, and then he kind of ran out of sauce in the second round and the third round, and he kind of went for those Adolfo Vieira panic takedowns, and he wasn't really able to get as many as you wanted.
I call those a Mac 1 Amir Khani, where I come from.
Round 2, round 3, so that was his detriment in that fight, and obviously he did lose against Hakprost, but his last two wins, one over Natan Levy, where he's very steady, worked the takedowns, one against Jesse Ronson, where he went for the takedowns. And Ronson was kind of in a similar bout to Drakkar Klose, where it was a long layoff. Now, Ronson didn't have the benefit of fighting a Brandon Jenkins. He got to fight Rafa Garcia. Rafa went takedown, 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 submission, which was a surprise to many. I thought if he was going to beat him, it was with his boxing. But you like the steadiness out of both these guys on the feet. I think they're going to bring a fun fight. This is like our third fight of the night, Matt. So when it does come down to it, we look at the odds to try and tell a bit of a story. Klose open to minus 185 favorite. Minus 228 right now for Rafa Garcia. Open to plus 160, plus 184. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us, they are to you. People love this segment of the show. Honest to God, I don't even know where to put it. I'm going to say Klose is a favorite. Klose is a fan favorite. I'm going to say over under 67.5% close, and I feel like it's going to be over.
I was going to set it at 65. If you didn't know, I think it will be over.
You think it's going to be over? Yeah, it's over. 1,000 votes on the nose, 87% close, 81% by decision, 12% by knockout for the 13% Garcia, 58% by decision, and some change in a finish. So the fans have close, the odds have close. Do you have close?
I do. Here's the thing. Jakar Close does struggle if you can evade him when he is being the leader of the dance. If he's walking forward, he sometimes can have limited success, I guess. I don't know why my brain just short-circuited thinking of that word, but for Jakar Close, it's weird. He's almost better when his opponent comes towards him and not vice versa. Well, this opponent was handmade to come at him with boxing combinations, and this is my issue. I think Rafa Garcia is going to eat a lot of damage on his way in. He's going to have to get close to really implement his own grappling style of game. I think Garcia can have some success in the striking, but at a certain point, again, the steadiness of Close with his jab, with his right hands, it's just a little bit more technical on the feet, and that's where I think he can have a little bit more success. He's going to find the minor details, almost like a small market baseball team, you know? You can't beat them with the outright talent, so we have to beat them in sort of the niche areas of the game. I think Jakar Close has a lot more technical ability in his game, and that's why I like him in this matchup.
Do you think they're going to fly Jakar Close and coach from Arizona to Texas like the A's tried to do with Paul Blackburn?
If you turn down $400 million from a team, they also won't charter you a private flight, so what do I know?
It's wild stuff, but when I do look at this matchup, you look at it for Close. He was originally supposed to take on Diego Ferreira, who's going to try and drive 8 hours to train in Dallas.
Good fighter, though.
But he's going to go for a lot of takedowns. You're going to get ready for that. For Garcia, the threat of the takedowns there, I think he's really accentuating his boxing in this one. But like you said, he's going to walk into combinations. This feels like a trap card fight like we just saw in the last card, Mason Jones, Ludwig Klein. So it does feel weird for me. I'm actually going with the underdog, Rafa Garcia, in this one. I think he's going to mix it up quite a bit. I do like Jakar Close as a fighter. You look at it in terms of striking output. You look at it in terms of accuracy and the pop at the end of the shots. Obviously, Close able to drop Brandon Jenkins round one, round two.
He also almost knocked out Benil Dariush in the second round of their fight. Benil's way better than Rafa Garcia.
100%. It was a while ago, though. So for me, I do like Garcia with the ability to mix it up. I like the strength of schedule for him. I like the fact that he's been the more active participant in the sport. And I think the short notice bout is going to help him out. I like that Justin Houghton connection at Pound for Pound Fitness at Elevation. So we're split on the pick. I'm going to go with gifted Rafa Garcia. You're going with Jakar Close to build it back up.
I look like a Jakar Close, almost like a Klay Thompson next season. We saw what he looked like in his first time back against a guy we probably should have beat, and he looked really good. I think he's going to look even better his second time out because he has the confidence of that first performance off of the long layoff under his belt, and I think that's a really key thing for a lot of these fighters. So that's why I do like Jakar Close. It's not just the talent, it's also the intangibles as well.
Good opportunity for both these fighters. Split on the pick. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. 13 fights on the card, 2 title fights up at the top. Nunes Pena in the rematch. Moreno Cara France in the rematch as well in the co-main. You're not going to want to miss. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. Originally set to be Lord Kong versus Justin Taffa coming up this weekend. We now have Dontale Mays, a man who's on a 2-fight win streak in the UFC after dropping a few contests coming off of the Contender Series. And he's going to be taking on probably one of the most interesting UFC signees in recent memory. It's the Hammer, Hamdi Abdelwahab, out of Egypt. He's 3-0 in MMA. Yes, 3-0. He's 2-0 in bare-knuckle boxing. He has an undefeated record as an amateur, but he does have a loss there. Why, Craig? Because he started to land hammer fists at the back of his opponent's head. So it's a TKO, illegal strikes. But when I do look at it in this fight, Hamdi Abdelwahab is not your average everyday 3-0 fighter because he represented Egypt at heavyweight over 98 kgs in the 2016 Rio Olympic Games as a Greco-Roman wrestler. Now, did he...
Pretty awesome.
Did he accomplish much at the Games? No, but he made the Games. You're watching this. You didn't make the Games. We didn't make the Games.
You're saying it like it's a negative. Why are you going after others already?
No, it's a giant positive. I mean, you look at Hamdi Abdelwahab, and this is kind of the weird thing about it. I mean, he does have 2 sub-minute knockouts in bare-knuckle boxing 2021. They weren't against the greatest level competition. But if you do look at it for Abdelwahab, the last guy that he fought was Matthew Strickland. And I was watching the fight, and I thought, you know what? I'm going to Google Matthew Strickland, see what we get out there. I'm going to throw a tweet up there to what Matthew Strickland, just overall appearance-wise, looked like. It wasn't the most impressive thing, but that's neither here nor there. He did finish him in impressive fashion. So you go through it. He beats Matthew Strickland, who he had knocked out in BKB, so it was a revenge rematch that nobody knew they needed. He fought Tyler Lee, who had Patty Pimblett hair, and early on in that fight, Tyler thought, I'm going to take it as a challenge. I'm going to run across the cage and take down the Olympian. He went for a single leg. He didn't get it, and then he just kind of dropped to the mat. Hamdi crosses the cage, hits him with one shot. Tyler Lee drops. So even before that, the first pro fight, he takes on Dustin Clements. They actually went at it.
They did.
They went at it. It was a fun fight. Hamdi ends up getting some takedowns. He mixes everything in. And at the end of it, Clements hurts his leg. Hamdi's trying to close the distance, and the referee ends the fight. But what I did like out of Hamdi Abdelwahab, as a guy who's billed as obviously an Olympian and so on and so forth, he has good takedowns. That much is true.
The guy who went to the Olympics for them?
He comes out of Killer B, which combat sports, you might know Carl Robertson trains there, was in the UFC. It was a roller coaster of emotions, but Corey Anderson's also at that gym. But I'm kind of surprised they brought Hamdi in, but if he's going to fight anybody, it's Dontell Mays.
Exactly, and that's the thing, but that's the appeal of this fight. Dontell Mays is a striker. Let's just call it what it is. A boxer, not even a striker. They're very rarely even throwing kicks. Hamdi Abdelwahab is a grappler. And that's really the appeal of this fight. Styles make fights, and these guys mix like oil and water. This is what I will say, though, and it should be a big X factor for this fight. Dontell Mays is much more experienced in the sport of MMA, and at a certain point, that is going to matter. He has been used to mixing his martial arts and not just using what got him to the days to begin with. The thing about Dontell Mays is he's had hard fights that he's been able to get through, and that's also a very important thing in the sport of MMA, where if you go back and watch Hamdi's fights, there's some weird performances, let's be honest. Like, there was a fight where he takes Buddy down, gets his back, lands 1,000 hammer fists to the back of his head, and they're like, yep.
That was the Corey Norman fight that he loses by illegal strikes.
It's just like, it's all very reckless. That's the best way I can, like, describe it. What I will say is, he's a quick grappler, and I'm going to bring up the movie Nacho Libre. Remember that woman
Libre.
Remember the woman who had the tunnels in the dollhouse? She was shifty, very quick. They didn't know where she was. That's what I think of when I see Hamdi grapple on the mat. He does have very fast knees. I know that's a weird thing to say, but he can shuffle around very quick when he does have top position if he is able to get to that spot. And I do think that'll be a key factor if he is able to get Dontell Mays in some extended grappling sequences, because of course Mays will not have the speed or the wherewithal of grappling like someone like Hamdi will on the mat, again, if he is able to get it to that position.
So for Hamdi, all but one fight was spent under the Icon or Gamebred FC banner, and if you do look at it, the one fight that he has that's not under that was when he fought 3-2 Tyler Lee, who looked like Patty Pimblett, but Patty on an off day in San Diego. That was on Freedom Fight Night. That was, they tried to replicate, the Ultimate Fighter. It was Team Rampage versus Team Ortiz. Jeez. And if you try and find it, it is out there. If you build it, they will come. But again, when I watch Hamdi fight, he runs in with reckless abandon throwing hooks. So straight shots will hit him. Doesn't have much in the way of striking defense. Has good offensive takedowns. When guys try to take him down, he has great sprawling hips, and I love to see that.
Could you imagine telling your fighter, though, like, hey, run across the cage and take this man down?
Tyler Lee's coaches did. But when I do watch it for Hamdi, when he gets the takedown, what do I do from here, coach? Because he gets in guard, and then he doesn't do anything.
I will say the side-controlled amount he is very fast in. Again, he's good at going from non-dominant positions to dominant positions. That's the only thing
But to me, it was, he holds it. He doesn't really have submissions. He doesn't really have ground and pound.
You're right.
And there's a lot of stand-ups in Hamdi fights where I would think, okay, Abdelwahab's going to be able to hold you down. For a guy like Dontell Mays, obviously he loses to my guy, Ciryl Gane, by heel hook. He loses to Rodrigo Nascimento. Good guy with his takedowns. Ricardo Prezel was really good at takedowns, good with rise and so on and so forth. He was able to knock him out. I know Alan Crowder has that big win over Dontell Mays, but on the two-fight win streak, Roky Martinez, last time out, Josh Parisian, where we saw Dontell Mays use not just his Kansas, but also his Indiana State Championship accolades in judo. Not that that's going to win him out a fight against Hamdi Abdelwahab, but Dontell Mays, I like him as a proven commodity, and his straight shot boxing is very good, and he trains out of a very good camp in Jackson Wink MMA to get him ready for this fight. So take it for what it's worth. We look at the odds in this one. Mays open plus 100, now minus 147. For the first Egyptian fighter to fight in the UFC, Abdelwahab, open minus 120, plus 121 as it sits, Matt. The over-under in Tapology, surprise us, it is to you. I'm going to say over under 65% maize.
I'll say over.
I'm going to say over. Slightly over. 930 total votes, 71% maize, 20% by decision, 72% by knockout. For the 29% that have Abdullah Hub, 77% by knockout. Matt, I think Dontayle Mays wins this fight.
I do, but again, I'm not sold on Dontayle Mays at all. Like, even if he wins this fight, it's not like he's going to be a ranked fighter, and that's the weird thing. Mays is in this weird heavyweight purgatory where he beats guys who are basically on their way out of the division, if we're being completely honest, and then he loses to anybody on top of that. So, really, it's going to be more of a how good does Hamdi look than what version of Dontayle Mays do we get, but I do agree with you. I do like his MMA experience, and I do think that's going to be his biggest X factor in this matchup.
This is how you gauge an MMA fan. You look at a guy like Hamdi Abdulwahab that's right at the 265 limit, 264.2 his last time out. Kind of swings like Jarjus Danho, the Man Mountain, kind of looks like him as well. So maybe you have the Olympian in this matchup. I like the straight shots out of Dontayle Mays, the complete game, but we're going to find out what both guys are made of on the weekend. Both of us going with Lord Kong to get the win, but let us know down below in the comment section. I'm really eager to hear from the Fight Night Picks fans on this particular matchup. We have 13 total fights on the card, two title fights up at the top that you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say, let's get into it. Lightweight action continues on the prelims. Coming up this weekend with 32 finish wins split between them, we have Colorado's Drew Dober taking on The Turn, Rafael Alves. The Turn. It's an interesting nickname for an interesting guy.
Blue Steel.
It is something, but when you look at Rafael Alves, this is a guy that I don't know why he thought, hey, I'm going to fight at 145 pounds, because that didn't work. He weighed in way over the limit for a previous fight. And realistically, the future is at 155. But you look at it, drops Demiris Magulov with one of the first shots that he throws, gets beat for like 13 minutes, and then rallies strong.
It's one of the greatest reversals you'll ever see in your whole entire life, where he goes from like his back, puts his knee on his Magulov's head, and somehow spun and pivoted on his own head. It's like some video game stuff that looked like a glitch while I was watching it.
He's a wild man, and if you considered his last time out, takes on Mark Giacchese, submits him in a spot where, hey, I'm Mark. I walk out now with knee pads, and I'm going to start to wrestle. Tried to do it against Alves, caught in a submission. So for Alves, you know him for his wild, fun striking style. He's a guy that'll do backflips and spins before the fight, which Paul Felder, I'm sure, cringes and hates. I'm here for it. I mean, expended energy notwithstanding. The guy's 31. The window is now, and he's 20-10. And early on in his career, he used to be a guy that, if you look at his record, Matt likes to bring it up, and it's the topic du jour. Nikita Krylov. He submits a lot of guys. He gets submitted a lot. Rafael Alves, of his losses, are primarily by submission. But he was the most 50-50 grappler when it came to it. So if you like a guy like, and I hate to make a Brazilian comparison in some of the lower weight classes, but Joanderson Brito. I'm going for it, or I'm not. Rafael Alves is that type of guy when it comes to his overall striking and grappling. He trains at MMA Masters, who made Danny Chavez and Colby Covington popular. Can they take credit for Colby Covington? I don't know. Maybe the last loss. But when you do look at it for Alves, a great opportunity in this one. And he was booked, of course, to take on Jared Gooden back in April. He withdrew. And his fight against Pat Sabatini was the one where he weighed a weight class too much for 145. So for Alves, a good opportunity against Drew Dober. And if you look at it for Dober, fight of the night against Frank Camacho, fight of the night against Brad Riddell. He's got performance bonuses over Alexander Hernandez and Nasrat Haqparast. And really, for Dober, his only real weakness, he likes to get into some barroom brawls inside of the cage, but his takedown defense, the only one that I can nitpick as being kind of the Achilles heel. And of his last four fights, he has been taken down 13 times in those ones.
So should Drew Dober walk out to ballroom blitz from now on?
I guess.
I mean, it would fit his fighting style. Again, Drew Dober is, there's people out there who say Drew Dober is their favorite fighter, and I don't doubt that they exist whatsoever. Like, you can't say that about everybody, so I feel like that's a pretty good test to see how well known you are in sort of the MMA sphere. Because you're right, Dober is known for having a lot of Fight of the Nights. And the thing is, when you have Fight of the Nights, they're great. They help line your checkbook. But they also take a little bit away from you every single time that we see you in the cage. And it's just the unfortunate reality of this sport, of combat sports, let's be honest. Like, And it sounds very dramatic, but it's the truth. You do leave a part of yourself in there. Think about Gustafsson last weekend. He was one of the all-time greats in his prime, and now you kind of see him reduced to what he is nowadays. It's no shame, but MMA's not a sport where you can go from being an MVP-caliber player to then just sort of being a bench player and contributing, but in your own kind of way. Like, the sport's still the same. It's still one-on-one, and you're going to take real damage no matter what stage of your career that you're at. And we've brought this up in a few fighters lately. I know Shane Burgos, we talked about that a lot leading up to his fight with Errol Jourdain. It was, hey, he's a really good fighter. We like the techniques, but how much have these fights taken from him? And good for Shane Burgos, he looked pretty good his last time out in what was a really close fight between him and Charles Jourdain. But I have to ask myself the exact same question when I break down a Drew Dober fight. He didn't look great in his last two losses, again, against two of the better fighters in the division. But his last time out against Terrence McKinney was an insane fight for as long as it lasted. He gets blasted by some big shots in the feet, gets hurt very badly, but to his credit, he was able to use that fight of the night experience that we all know he has, and he was able to rally back and really put it on McKinney by the end of that fight. Like, that was a masterclass of what like will means in MMA, because Drew Dober did not want to lose that fight, and it was a wild exchange to see him get the dub. But that's the thing I have to ask myself. Okay, Drew Dober, we know he has power from the first minute of the fight to the last minute of the fight. He's a steady fighter who will be able to eat a shot and give a shot. Do you think this fight's almost like the tides in Fundy, where at the start of the fight, Alves will be the stronger guy? The tides are going to be very high. But every minute that chips away, it's just going to go a little bit more in Drew Dober's favor, a little bit more in Drew Dober's favor. And that's the thing about Alves. And the thing about a lot of these grapplers who have a lot of submission wins, but a lot of submission losses too, cardio tends to be their Achilles heel. It's not that they're getting submitted because they're the worst grappler in the matchup. It's that, listen, I don't care how skilled you are in any sport. You can be great at baseball. You can be great at basketball, football, any sport. If you get tired, your skill set is going to be diminished. And I do think that's the sort of, that's the issue with Alves throughout a lot of his fighting styles. He's going to start out very strong. And yes, against Ismagulov, he was able to rally a little bit late, but that was a lot because Ismagulov had lost some steam himself because he was able to put it on Alves, I think, a lot in the second round. So I just don't really know what version we're going to get of Alves as this fight goes on. We're at least more confident in the versions of Drew Dober I'm going to see from the first round to the third round.
Because for Alves, he takes that fight against Ismagulov, and I mean, he knocks him down in the first round. He lands two significant strikes. Outstruck 17-2, loses the first round, loses the second round 24-12 for the strikes. So Alves wakes up a little bit more. And then in the third round, Alves outstrikes Ismagulov. He had him in some compromising positions.
Well, for significant strikes, Ismagulov outstruck him.
But, I mean, yeah, he landed three more strikes. But the point of it is, Alves won the third round of that fight. So 29-28, Ismagulov, Alves rallies. The point of the story is, Alves looked kind of lost at the start. After he dropped him, he kind of had to find his way back into the fight. And I've seen Alves fights where his first round's really good, his second round's good, and then he finishes the guy, and we don't have to worry about the third round. But that is my big question with Rafael Alves, is how good's the cardio? Because I know how good Drew Dober's is, and I look at the odds in this fight. Minus 300 is where Dober opened. Minus 223, minus 225 is where they're at right now for Brazil's The Turn. Or do we call him The Fade? I mean, he is the underdog.
Blue open, Steel's the new name.
Open plus 250. He's now at a plus 180. We have a look at the top algebra. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over under 72.5% on Drew Dober.
I think it'll be in the 60s for Dober.
All right. Ooh, it's 1,154 total votes.
You looked at these before.
No, I didn't. 79% Drew Dober, 47% by decision, 42% by knockout for the 21% that have Alves, 55% by submission, Matt. Alves likes to rush in. Drew Dober's a tricky southpaw with a lot of power. We've seen wrestlers try and rush in against him. I mean, Alexander Hernandez, one of them. So I do, you know, take that into consideration in this fight. Let's pick here.
This is the area of the game that I think Alves could take advantage of that McKinney wasn't. After McKinney hurt Drew Dober, he went to wrestling. Wrestling Drew Dober is not the best idea because he can counter some of that wrestling and it gives him a chance to clear the cobwebs. Alves won't wrestle with Drew Dober. He's going to go for a submission if he gets him hurt. So I do think there's a world where he's able to hurt Drew Dober with a big shot like he did Mark Jacquesi, run across the cage, and very similar to how he was able to finish Jacquesi, hurt him with a shot, guillotine him. I can see a very similar sequence happening in this fight with Dober because Dober will sometimes shoot right after he gets hurt by a shot, and I could see that opening up an avenue for Alves to finish by submission, but I do think the steadiness of Drew Dober is something that you cannot discount in this matchup. He knows how to get through a tough fight, and that's something that really, unless you've been through those fight of the year quality fights, you're never really going to have that type of experience. So ever so slightly I'm going to favor Drew Dober, but I'm surprised to see he's over a 2-1 favorite in this matchup because I feel like the people who know how dangerous Alves is,
and for that reason I have the Brazilian in this fight. Again, for me it's Drew Dober. The takedowns, you consider the fighters. Islam Makhachev's taking you down, it's hard to get back up. But you look at it, Brad Riddell mixing in the wrestling and finding success in that area. It was a fight of the night at UFC 263. Fravish, though, lights out when he gets it to the mat. And when it comes to his jiu-jitsu, it's really hard to get out from under him. So if it does wear on, yes, I see Drew Dober winning this one. If Alves makes a big action to close distance, I think he's going to get countered by Drew Dober. And he could get put out in those exchanges. But I do like Alves with the fact that he is so grappling-oriented. And once he gets those takedowns, it really can be night-night. So for me, I'm going to go with the underdog in the turn. Blue Steel, Rafael Alves to get the win. You're going to go with a man who has the Strikeforce experience. And he's been in the UFC for a very long time. In Drew Dober to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in this matchup. Because, Matt, we have this in our fight and right screen. It should be a lot of fun. We have 13 fights on the card, 2 rematches in the title fights up at the top that you're not going to want to miss, so keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
This weekend at middleweight, we've almost reached the 2-year mark of the Semi the Jedi experience with Matthew Semelsberger in the UFC. He's 4-1 in that time. He's going to be taking on his biggest test to date in the great white Alex Morono. Matt, if I told you 2 years ago that Matthew Semelsberger would be 4-1 in the UFC, knocking on the rankings, I just ruined a cat's day, and my dog started to bark. But when we do look at this, like, would you believe me if I told you that?
These fighters were on very different trajectories around that time, because you're right, Alex Morono was almost seen as that guy who was knocking on the rankings, who had a lot of promise, though well-rounded. Not really prospect, because he had been around for a little while before he came to the UFC, but there was a lot of promise in the career of Alex Morono. But it has felt like the tides have sort of shifted in this matchup, to where now Semelsberger is seen as sort of the fighter with more promise out of these two, which is odd, because Alex Morono has been in some very high-profile fights throughout his young UFC tenure.
But I mean, you look at it, like, for Semelsberger, comes in, fights Carlton Minus, complete performance, drops him early. He does win, a performance of the night bonus, and I take a little bit of a pause, because he beats Jason Witt with a jab down the middle. He beats Martin Sanoh, and that is a fight, you're never going to see Martin Sanoh in the UFC again. He loses to Chaos Williams in a back-and-forth fight.
It's going to happen, though.
The weirdest part about it, though, is doesn't wrestle at all against Chaos Williams, goes strike for strike. Williams lands the bigger shots, lands more volume, and he's able to win out there. And then for Semelsberger's last time out, fights AJ Fletcher in a fight I can only talk about in the fact that UFC fans thought that AJ Fletcher won that fight overwhelmingly. You can make an argument. I mean, I can talk MMA decisions, so on and so forth. I thought Semelsberger won, but Fletcher made it competitive in that one, didn't he?
He certainly did. Again, I don't get caught up in decisions. It doesn't change what either guy does stylistically in their fights. This is my big thing with Matthew Semelsberger coming into this matchup, though. We were joking about this before we started filming. He might have one of the biggest size advantages we've ever seen outside the heavyweight division in this matchup, and I really do think that's going to play a huge factor in this fight, because for Alex Morono, we've seen him at the welterweight division honestly not look very big. Like, even when he fought Cowboy Cerrone, Cowboy looked to be the bigger fighter in that matchup, and Cowboy spent the majority of his career, at least the prime of his career, down at the lightweight division. So I'm very curious to see how Alex Morono's punching power is going to translate in this matchup, because he's going to have a really hard time hurting the much bigger Semelsberger on the feet, and how does that affect his wrestling defense? Because let's say Semelsberger does enter this fight with Marve wrestling mindset. You're right, you would think if we ever saw that side of him in the UFC, it would have been in that Chaos Williams fight, but he was more than happy to go strike for strike with a guy who I definitely wouldn't if I was in the UFC, because Chaos Williams...
Alex Morono tried to do it for 10 seconds. He got vaporized.
It was awful. Like, Chaos Williams is terrifying when he plants and throws. But the one thing I will say about Semelsberger was that was the first fight where I didn't think he looked lost on his feet. Like, I do think he has made a lot of improvements with his striking throughout his MMA career, because especially early on, someone like Justin Gaethje, like, he wrestled a lot early in his career, but he has been able to grow the part of his game, the striking part of his game, a lot, especially throughout this part of his career. But again, I cannot get away from the size advantage that I think Semelsberger is going to have on fight night.
Semelsberger has middleweight experience, light heavyweight experience. As an amateur, he's 2 inches taller, he's 3 inches longer, and he was a strong safety at Marist College. And I'll throw the picture up there, because he looks like a wild man, and he played football at like 215. Like, he has a loss at light heavyweight to William Knight as an amateur. These are crazy things, but they're true. And for Alex Morono, he came in at UFC 195, one of Matt's favorite main events, Robbie Lawler, Carlos
Condit. One of the great
Condit.
Fights of all time.
Great fight, but if you look at it, 10-4 in the UFC with a no contest. Like, it's crazy for Alex Morono.
Do you know what my favorite stat about UFC 195 is?
No.
The first fight on the card, the first ever UFC Fight Pass prelim, Joe Duffy versus Dustin Poirier, one of the great prelim fights of all time.
Amazing stuff. And for Alex Morono, former Legacy welterweight champ, there used to be RFA, there was Legacy, they merged, but Morono was a champ over there. And I look at it, yeah, he got vaporized by Chaos Williams. And yeah, some of those losses, I mean, maybe you don't love him. He owns his own gym, co-owns it with his wife, Gracie Baja Woodlands. The Woodlands MMA, new building, so you'll love to see that for Morono. For Semmelsberger, comes out of Crazy 8 MMA, bit of a smaller gym in Maryland. Coach is John Delbrug, and we talked about it a lot. But for Morono, when it comes to the overall skill sets in MMA, Alex Morono, black belt in Taekwondo, black belt in Jiu-Jitsu. Like, he really does have those. And if you want to pick a Morono fight, there's a lot of them that I could go with. The Max Griffin fight, I think that plays well in this one. Great volume, great power. You look at Morono against Mickey Gall. 30-27s, like, he did look really good in that fight. Morono's a more complete fighter. It's just, how is the size and the length that Semmelsberger play in? Because Semmelsberger has good offensive wrestling. Slowed a little bit at the end of that minus fight, but he was able to hold on. My big knock against Semmelsberger, because I've been a rah-rah Semmelsberger guy the whole time. I've been the guy. It's early on as a pro, he could get kind of stalled out and caught on his back in some of his fights. I think he's kind of fixed that. I think he can kind of scramble up and out of bad positions. Against Morono, we'll see how that one plays out. But I like this fight stylistically. And honest to goodness, I got to be honest, I have a hard time picking this one.
I do, but I do think that there's one situation in this fight that's heavily going to favor Matthew Semmelsberger, and this is why. Alex Morono is more of a volume striker. I know he has some really nice knockdowns, of course, the head kick on Max Griffin. He has the other head kick on Cowboy where he hurts him with the flurry after. But go back to the Reese McKee fight. Reese McKee's not the greatest fighter of all time, but Alex Morono beat him in a very one-sided fight. He was getting pretty sloppy at the end of that fight based on his volume. And I know he threw 200 punches in that fight, so it's tough for me to not to expect him to tire as that fight goes on. But I think he's going to have a very similar game plan in this matchup. He's going to have to throw a lot at Semmelsberger to really get him thinking. Because if Semmelsberger can just go one shot for one shot with Alex Morono, he's probably going to end up knocking him out in the middle of the second round. Like, that's how much more powerful Semmelsberger is. But if Morono can hit him with some volume, make him miss a little bit, get him frustrated on the feet, I do think it'll open up an avenue for Morono to win. But the problem is, I don't think Morono has the Goldilocks zone for his own striking volume down just yet. I think if he does go into this fight with a volume heavy mindset, it's going to get him caught later on as the fight progresses, because I don't think Morono has enough overwhelming volume to go out there and just finish Semmelsberger up against the cage, for instance, kind of a TKO win where the ref helps him. That he has the one-punch knockout power to go out there and put down Semmelsberger with one shot. And I think both of those situations favor Semmelsberger as this fight goes on, because let's say Morono does fight like he did in the third round of that Reese McKee fight, where his hands are down, he is getting sloppy, he's getting hit by some shots. That's going to open up a big window for Semmelsberger to land some big counters down the middle.
Yeah, Semmelsberger got mopped in the first round of his fight against a short-notice AJ Fletcher, making his UFC debut out of Louisiana. In the second round, Semmelsberger won. In the third round, Semmelsberger won. And again, a lot of people like to credit the takedowns of Fletcher in the second round, and they think that he won the fight, but that's neither here nor there. We have a look at the odds. Semmelsberger, the favorite, opened at par. He's minus 166 right now. The comeback on Morono at a plus 137. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to assume this one's close. I'm going to say Morono favored 60% over under.
I think I'll be the favorite, but I'll say under.
You're going to say under. It's really close. Semmelsberger. So 1,057 total votes, 54% Semmelsberger, 38% by decision, 54% by knockout. For the 46% that are Morono, 84% by decision. So a fair amount going with Semmelsberger to win by knockout. Size, wrestling, long strikes to beat Morono. That's how the people are thinking this one's going to go.
And I agree with the people, if I'm being honest. Again, for Alex Morono, I just think where he's going to have a lot of success is also a very dangerous area for him in this matchup. Again, against some other smaller guys in the division, he can overwhelm them with his volume, but I think at a certain point, it is going to get him caught with his feet planted in a bad position. So ever so slightly going to favor Matthew Semmelsberger, but he could get overwhelmed by that same volume that I'm talking about. There's a world out there where he almost looks like Uriah Hall when he fought Sean Strickland, where he is on the back foot, kind of waiting for that one perfect counter, but it never comes. So I'm going to say ever so slightly Semmelsberger, but I think this will be a really fun fight.
And like I said, I'm on the fence on this one. I've gone with a fair amount of underdogs already on the card. I'm going to go with Semmelsberger as the favorite based on the fact that Morono has really good jiu-jitsu, but sometimes he can stall out off his back and he is susceptible to getting taken down. We saw that in some of his previous fights. Max Griffin was able to exploit that a little bit. Ultimately, Morono won that fight and he did look very good. So I like the volume out of Morono. I like that he actually uses Taekwondo black belt in MMA very, very well. But for me, I do like Samuelsberger as the more raw fighter who has quite a bit less experience. So both of us in this fight going with Semi the Jedi to get the win. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Let us know down below in the comments section if I should go with the guy that in the back of my mind I think might win in Morono, or if I go with my brain and go with Matt Semelsberger. We're both in agreement with Semelsberger here. 13 total fights, 2 title fights up at the top. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, Matt, and as we always say, let's get into it. Light heavyweights who are not paid by the hour coming up this weekend on the main card of UFC 277, which you can catch us here on the channel with the Fight Night Picks sidekick, as always, during that pay-per-view portion with the commentary and so on and so forth. We have Magomed Ankalaev looking to put that 17-1 record up against Lionheart Anthony Smith, who was an illegal knee away from taking the belt from John Jones.
He also lost every round 10-8.
But since that fight, it has been an interesting run for Smith. Of course, he does have that fight against Alexander Rakic that definitely didn't go his way. That was a 3-round main event where he did get beat quite badly. But then he comes back, beats Devin Clark, beats Jimmy Crute, beats Ryan Spann. Oh yeah, all 3 of those wins by finish. So for Anthony Smith, back on the horse, thriving as ever. And for Smith, I say this, but a finisher to the nth degree. His average fight time, UFC and Strikeforce, 9 minutes and change. So he really does like to get it done quite quickly. His most impressive wins, like I said, the 3-fight win streak there, the Volkan Oezdemir fight, Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada, to get him right up near the top.
Go ahead. That gives more credit to the point that his fights were only 9 minutes. It'd be one thing if his average fight time was 15 minutes. This guy's been in a lot of main events for the UFC, so he has an extra 10 minutes to work with, and he still doesn't even make use of them.
2-2 with Strikeforce is Smith, 11-6 with the UFC against some very good competition. And if you look at it for his opponent out of Russia, Magomed Ankalaev, an interesting case because he was winning against Paul Craig until he didn't have the fight IQ of Volkan Oezdemir and decided that the mat is not lava. It's very cool. It's like a pool and I should jump into this 82 degree weather. Got submitted in the final
second. Paul Craig's guard, the cool side of the pillow.
Got submitted in that one. But again, he's 8-0 since. He has performance bonuses against Marcin Prochniow, Dalcha Linjambula, and Iwan Kutsalaba in the rematch. And if you look at it for Ankalaev, had a main event his last time out, beat Thiago Santos to earn the spot on a pay-per-view card, and it was a good fight, I guess.
I feel like he lost stock in a win, if we're being completely honest. Sometimes you can gain stock in a loss, sometimes you can lose stock in a win. Nobody thought Thiago Santos had a snowball's chance in hell of winning that fight, and it was pretty damn close upon further review. Like, Ankalaev did a good job at range, he was able to pitter-patter a little bit, but anytime they get into an extended boxing sequence, Thiago Santos was able to hit him with some shots, and even dropped him at one point throughout that fight. So, for Ankalaev, this is almost sort of a readjustment fight, it feels like. Like, Anthony Smith and Thiago Santos at this stage of their careers are basically in the exact same position. It's, hey, if you're a prospect with some promise, this is a great guy to beat because good things happen after you fight them. But that's the weird thing about Anthony Smith. He almost had like a Jorge Masvidal career revitalization midway through his 30s. We don't often see somebody, you know, be a popular fighter, but maybe not a great fighter statistically. And then all of a sudden he went on a great run once he went up to the 205-pound division. He did enjoy quite a bit of success in his short time in the division. Knocked out Rashad Evans, knocked out Shogun Hua. Like, he was on that exciting run, but that was the problem. He got a title shot based off beating a lot of aging legends and Volkan Oezdemir, who, again, is a good fighter when he's on, but is a bit inconsistent, if we're all being honest. So for Anthony Smith, it feels like he was sort of crowned as a championship-quality fighter a little bit prematurely in his UFC tenure, and that's why we have seen the run ever since his title shot. He can offer an interesting fight to a lot of strong prospects, and not everyone's going to get past the Anthony Smith litmus test. He is very much like Derek Brunson, where, again, if you beat him, you're probably fighting for a title or you're getting main events in the future. But if you lose to him, it normally is going back to the drawing board. And the thing about Anthony Smith is, I think his best win as of late was the Jimmy Crute performance. I know it ended by a weird kind of fluky injury, but up until that point, his jab was landing well. He was fighting in a very smart manner, and he was fighting tall too, which is something that Anthony Smith has always struggled with throughout his career. When he gets backed up to the cage, you know how much I hate this. When he shells up and tries to paw away with that lead leg, it's just not a great look, to be honest. No judge is ever going to give you a round where you've spent 3 minutes of it with your back up against the cage in a 100% defensive shell. Now, Anthony Smith can sort of play a rope-a-dope game like that where you're throwing a lot of shots, he's making you miss. He has exceptional cardio for this division, and he's normally able to weaponize that pace on a lot of fighters. But this is why I don't think that's going to really matter in this fight. Does Ankalaev fight at much of a pace? Not really. He's happy to stand on the outside, play your game a little bit, and then pot you with some shots from the outside. I just think this is going to be a very low-volume Anthony Smith fight, which normally isn't something I'd be saying.
When Smith presses a pace against an opponent, when he's starting to land all the way across the cage, when he mixes in his kicks, he wins. He beats you down on the feet to get you to the mat to submit you. That's a classic blueprint
of a damaging jab.
Of a Smith fight. Yeah, damaging jab. He can fight long at times. Again, he's going to have a height advantage. He's going to have a slight reach advantage. He's a fighter that uses those tools well. We talk about height and reach. It's stupid how much they accentuate it in a lot of the broadcasts because if you have it, prove it. Like, if I've never seen it...
It's just a stat, guys. There's negatives and positives to everything. It is just a stat. Oh, it's not a benefit or a negative.
The man or woman's the Easter Bunny. Haven't seen it. Where is it? But when I look at Magomed Ankalaev, he does fight in a similar fashion. But the thing that I like about Anthony Smith is a double-edged sword. His kicks are good. He doesn't check leg kicks all that well. And his knees swell up a lot. Like, a lot. It's like our grandmother who has arthritis in all of her fingers. It looks like little baseball mitts on every knuckle. They're huge. His knee, it's like that. It gets kicked, it looks like a catcher's mitt. It looks like a first baseman's
mitt. You're lucky your grandmother doesn't have internet access. I don't know if she'd be thrilled with you talking about
UFC 229. She watched the co-main event. She went, well, boys, I'm going to bed. She missed Conor and Khabib. So that's the level of MMA fan she is. But credit to her for staying up for the rest of the fights or the fights that were there. When it comes to Magomed Ankalaev, very accurate, very efficient with his striking. The thing that I like about Ankalaev that counters well against Smith, if Smith comes in high tie guard like we know he will, Ankalaev can kick to the body. That's a huge detriment to Anthony Smith. Obviously, you've seen the front kick knockout performance bonus that Ankalaev had against Dalshil and Jambula. He uses kicks very well. Here's the thing about Magomed Ankalaev. He could fight Anthony Smith. He could fight Volkan Oezdemir. He could fight Ihor Pretseria, who's on the undercard of this card, and Ihor could have success. Thiago Santos threw a winging left hand that dropped Magomed Ankalaev in the second round of their fight. Ihor does the same damn thing. And if he rushed Ankalaev, if he's quick enough, he could drop him. The counter is Ankalaev could throw his really straight, efficient shots like he did against Kutsalaba fight one or fight two. He could finish his opponents. But against Santos, it dropped him in the second round. He had to kind of work back in round three, four, and five.
And that's the problem with Ankalaev. He does like to counter with one shot and then he'll kind of wait. And wait, and wait, and if you are a fighter like Anthony Smith, who fights at an extremely high, or with an extremely high work rate, I do think that there's a world where Anthony Smith can have a lot of success, but the problem is, you know what Anthony Smith doesn't take well at all? Body shots, ever. Has never throughout his career, Thiago Santos famously stopped him with one. I would go back to the main event he had against Alexander Gustafsson, where Gustafsson does not have a lot of success in that fight, but you know what he does do? He body kicks him in the second round that folds Anthony Smith over, and Gustafsson's able to get on top and end the round out in a very dominant position. It's always been a shot that Anthony Smith has been susceptible to, and not just at the middleweight division. That's why I bring up the Gustafsson fight as well. He just doesn't take body shots all that well, and against a guy like Ankalaev, who can mix his kicks up to all three levels, I think that's going to be something Smith really has to watch out for. But again, I have a very hard time putting Ankalaev in the whole hierarchy of the light heavyweight division, and I let everybody know this every time I break down one of his fights. Again, if you just look at the snapshots of some of the skills he's able to portray in MMA fights, he will look phenomenal. But then you start to look at some of the intangibles that other fighters have that he doesn't seem to have, and you do get concerned when he starts to go up against guys like maybe a Jamal Hill, who's a lot younger, who's someone who will get into a lot of those elongated exchanges, especially in boxing distance. I just think there's guys out there who are going to give Ankalaev a really tough time, and they have matched him up in sort of a smart way up until this point. They figured out, okay, it was a bad loss to Paul Craig. Let's build this guy back up. He got the two wins against Kutalaba. That was stupid. Like, he beat him the first time. He shouldn't have had to fight him again. So for Ankalaev, this is going to be a very big building block. But I gotta be honest, even if he beats Anthony Smith, I don't think I'm gonna be ready to say, wow, he's the next guy in line.
When I watch Ankalaev, it's like watching a quarterback that's got a hell of an arm, but he doesn't have any in-game IQ. Like, we're at the 45 on our own side, and we're going ISO. We're going 1 yard run. Now we're second down. 1 yard run. Now we're third down. Let's air the fucker out and see what happens. And for Ankalaev, I mean, other than the Paul Craig one, he aired it out into an INT that got returned for a pick six.
So he's like 2011 Phillip Rivers is what you're saying. The highs are high, but the lows are low.
Big man's thrown. He's got a lot of mouths to feed. So for Ankalaev, I don't know about that portion of it, but big dick Phil.
Phillip Rivers could throw 78 interceptions a year. People would be like, he's as good as Drew Brees. Shut up.
I'm glad that we kept him, say Chargers fans. But for Ankalaev, you look at it in this one, open minus 400, minus 500 right now. For Anthony Smith, open plus 300, plus 360. We have a look at the Topology votes. I don't expect them to be close. I'm going to say over under 75% ankle IF.
I think it'll be in the 90s.
Yeah. Oh, close. No, not yet. 1,250 total votes, 85% ankle IF, 75% by decision, 16% by knockout. For the 15% that have Ole Smith, it's a polar pop. We've got 40% by decision. We got 23% by knockout, 30% by submission. I think Ankalaev wins this at range. I think he's going to be able to get it done. I wouldn't put any money on it because minus 500 is too rich for my blood. And I like Anthony Smith in a lot of his fights. And I like the way that he can beat you in any different way. It's just he has his own things that you have to watch out for. So I do like Ankalaev for all the reasons I stated in the video. But it should be a fun fight.
Oh, I can say this without, like, I don't care about either one of these fighters outside of their skill sets. I prefer watching Anthony Smith a whole hell of a lot more than I prefer watching Magomed Ankalaev.
Tell us how you really feel.
It's just the truth. Like, Anthony Smith is a genuinely exciting fighter no matter who you put him up against, unless he fights a dominant wrestler where he can't work his jiu-jitsu off his back. Ankalaev is a low volume striker who does make the most of his shots, and that's why I do think he's gonna be able to win this fight. Again, at kicking range, he's a lot more lethal with his shots than Anthony Smith is. Again, Smith is good at that range too, but he's a much more volume oriented striker than what Ankalaev is. So again, similar to what I mentioned on the last fight between Morono and Semelsberger, maybe Smith is able to overwhelm Ankalaev with a lot of his shots, but I do think he's gonna walk into a big shot from Ankalaev at a certain point. And the thing is, we saw Rakic just out wrestle Anthony Smith for 15 minutes, and he just laid on top of him. Ankalaev has the ability to do the exact same thing.
Both of us going with Magomed Ankalaev to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. This main card is wild, and Alessandro Pantoja is taking on Alex Perez next. You're not going to want to miss this. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.
Fingers crossed both these men make the walk. Coming up this weekend, Flyweight Never Die. We have Ultimate Fighter alum Alessandro Pantoja, the Cannibal, taking on Dana White's Contender Series, former title challenger Alex Perez. And if you're watching this fight, if you have friends that are at all interested in MMA, this is the litmus test. It's like if you went to a house party and maybe you had friends there and maybe you had family there and you've got like a Spotify playlist on, or if you got Craig's Mix, because everybody knows I'm a big Billy Strings fan. Everybody hit me up with that one last week.
How many house parties do you go to where you also see your family there? Because I don't think I've ever been to one.
Maybe it's like a graduation party or a wedding, but you're playing your own playlist and then you've got the song Lost in the Fire that comes on, the big weekend song, and it starts to play and you hear the synth at the start and you go, well, this can go one of two ways. Either everybody at this party is cool as fuck, or when they get the, I wanna fuck you slow with the lights on.
They released that song because the last season of Game of Thrones, fun fact.
You have two opportunities. Either you hear the synth and you skip it because grandma's here, or everybody's cool and then we get to the part, well, baby, you can bring a friend. She can ride on top your face. Well, I fuck you straight.
What does any of this have to do with this fight, Craig?
Either your friends are cool as shit and they like a fight between Alessandro Pantoja and Alex Perez like I like, or they go, flyweights, let's skip this one. Don't skip
it. You really wanted to make that work.
The best fight of the weekend, and if you're cool and if you're a fan of Fight Night Picks, you're going to love it. Because for Alessandro Pantoja, he's taken on a wicked level of fights in the UFC. All the best guys except for Demetrius Johnson when he was around. And for Alex Perez, wild run after Dana White's Contender Series, but he hasn't fought since November 2020 when he challenged for the belt and got submitted by Deiveson Figueiredo. And since then, six fight bookings have fallen out. Two of them against Askar Askarov, four of them against Matt Schnell, and it's just been unfortunate because I feel like people are going to forget how good Alex Perez is or was through this long layoff.
I'm still trying to just digest the choice of lyrics you decided to sing next to your brother. I feel slightly uncomfortable now. Here's the thing about Alex Perez. He's turning into Flyweight's Brandon Roy, and that's not a guy you want to be compared to. The talent is obvious. We all know how good Alex Perez is when he fights, and he's one of the few guys who look good in a first-round stoppage loss against Deiveson Figueiredo. He's beaten his leg up, he's landed some good shots of his own, goes for an awful takedown and gets guillotined by one of the most dangerous guillotines of all time. But still, Perez did show a lot of promise on his rise-up through the ranks, and I know people like to point to some losses that he had earlier on in his career, but like, there's a reason he got the first title shot coming off Contender Series. He is an extremely talented wrestle boxer who has very good kicks to add in too. He really does remind me of sort of the next generation of like a Joseph Benavidez, because there's a lot of similarities between their games. They both value speed over power, they both have a very well-rounded game, they both excel at their best when they're able to mix their martial arts. But my big point with this fight is Pantoja just seems to be more lethal in a lot of these positions. And with Pantoja, he's one of the few flyweights who can knock you out on the feet with one punch. He can submit you very quick if it does go on the mat. The weird thing about Pantoja is he doesn't necessarily fatigue in the traditional way that a power puncher would. Normally, you watch a power puncher, they throw a lot of winging shots, they get very tired as a result. Pantoja will keep his cardio when he's forced to strike, but the one issue with his game plan is if he does have to wrestle a lot throughout his game or throughout his fights, that does tend to wear on him throughout them. I always go to the Askarov fight when I want to point this out because him and Askarov are having very good exchanges on the feet. I'd say Pantoja's getting the better of a lot of them, but when they go into wrestling, Pantoja can have success early. But Askarov is just relentless with a lot of his takedowns and with his grappling, and that's where Pantoja can start to get behind on some of these fights, and that's an area where Perez can have a lot of similar success.
That's Perez's biggest X factor, is his wrestling. Okay. When you look at his fights, I mean, obviously, you brought up the leg kicks. I mean, people forget how good Jussie Formiga was. I mean, he beat Deiveson Figueiredo, but, you know, he's past 35, at 125. He's taking on Alex Perez, and credit to Perez. Those leg kicks, lethal. He's able to get a performance bonus there. He had a performance when he submitted Jordan Espinoza as well. Big bonus there. Obviously, losses in the UFC is 6-2, the one for the title, and he got TKO'd on the ground by Joseph Benavidez.
Surprising loss at the time.
To be the interim champ challenger, you got to beat the interim champ challenger two times? I don't know. Poor Joe B, the way that he had to go out. But when you do look at it for Perez, out of all of the fights that came and went out of the six, he was supposed to fight at UFC 271 against Matt Schnell, and he weighed in at 128 pounds, and then they wouldn't let him fight. So you hate to see that. Originally, this was supposed to be Alex Perez versus Askar Askarov for a couple of cards ago. It was supposed to be the big ABC card.
Hopefully we still get that fight.
Yeah, Askarov out, so we do get Pantoja. And for Pantoja, you bring it up. He struggles in some of those wrestling sequences. Doesn't throw a ton of kicks, but he makes them count as well. But when you look at this one, if you're just a numbers guy and you're putting the glasses up, Alex Perez is actually better in every single statistical category except for one, striking accuracy. 48% for Pantoja, 47% for Alex Perez. But where I would counter that argument is Pantoja's taking on the way better level of competition all the way up through.
And to quote Daniel Cormier, not every significant strike is created equally. Like, Pantoja hits a whole hell of a lot harder than Alex Perez does, and there's nothing either guy can do physically that's ever going to change that. Like, Perez's body style and whole fighting style is, I'm going to hit you with a lot of volume with my boxing, make you get your hands up, then I'm going to go in for the takedown, then I'm going to mix in the leg kick. It's a very segmented game, but they all do work together in a really nice package. The issue is, Pantoja, especially for those first two rounds, not say he's the perfect fighter by any means, because there are guys who are a little bit more of a specialist than he is. Guys like Askarov who can out-wrestle him. Guys like Figueiredo who can slightly outstrike him. And I'd really say Figueiredo's the only guy who can have a lot of success with him on the feet. And that's what my big issue is with picking Perez in this matchup. Think about if you're Alex Perez in this fight. You can't box your opponent. You can throw kicks with them, but it's also going to make you susceptible to getting taken down by the guy who's very dangerous with his own jiu-jitsu. And even if Perez is able to take down Pantoja, that's no cakewalk either. I mean, Pantoja's good at getting back up to his feet. He is a very crafty grappler off his back, too. I was bringing up to Craig that wild, like, sequence where he went through the legs of Askarov and somehow took his back. Like, it reminded me, Fabricio Verdum did that against Alexander Volkov before he lost to him. But it's a very unorthodox method that you don't often see. It's very Damian Maia-esque. It's all based off a single-leg takedown where instead of completing the takedown, you then basically give your back between the legs and take the back of your opponent. It's some high-level stuff, to say the least.
If you like Dana White's Contender Series, Andreas Luna Martinetti did that in his last fight before making his Contender Series appearance.
So for Pantoja, I do think he is the complete package. It's been really difficult for him to break through because, again, he had that very close fight with Askar Askarov. That Askar did win, but still a very close fight. And then he had one of the greatest fights in the division's history against Deiveson Figueiredo, where those guys just throw bombs at each other. Pantoja gets dropped in the second round, rallies in the third to where they're just like throwing canned heat at each other. Great fight between the two. But that's the thing for Pantoja. Like, I really do enjoy watching his fighting style. I would love to see him fight for the title one day, but he is 32 years old. So at some point, he's going to have to get that marquee win that does get him to the top of the ranks to get in that title picture. Because right now, he's at least on the same level of as Askarov, you could say. But the fact that he has looked so good in his last two performances maybe has pushed him ahead. But if he beats Perez, that's my real question. Does he fight Figueiredo next? Does he fight the loser of the co-main event? Like, I don't really know exactly what his path is to the title. I just know he gets a lot closer to it if he is able to beat Alex Perez.
No more Walid Ismail as manager for Deiveson Figueiredo. So Figueiredo's now got a California connection in his management. We'll see if he moves up to 135. The top half is kind of log-jammed in this division. Obviously, you wouldn't be if you didn't have an interim fight at the top of this card. I think the winner of this fight, if it's Perez, Probably one more. Pantoja wins. He gets a title shot. Kind of like last weekend, Tom Aspinall, Curtis Blaydes. If Aspinall wins, title shot.
Pantoja's 2-0 against Brandon Moreno, too. And that's something nobody talks about. Like, Pantoja's the reason Brandon Moreno was the LFA bantamweight champion. I guess he wasn't the flyweight champion. It was bantamweight, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So that was the thing. Like, Pantoja beat the brakes off him in The Ultimate Fighter. Then they did the rematch when a lot of people were confident Brandon Moreno was going to look a lot better. And he looked like a drunk Dominic Cruz in that fight.
And
Pantoja beat him so
and
bad.
Pantoja, again, pitter-patter, let's get out, or letter Kenny against Manel Kopp and Kopp's UFC debut, and that was a year and 4 months ago. Pantoja doesn't fight all that often. Like, 9 months ago, and again, neither does Alex Perez, and looked great against Brandon Royval finishing him. So the odds in this one, Pantoja open to minus 275, minus 165 right now. For Perez, open plus 235, plus 138 right now. I doubt, listen, surprise test it is to you, that these votes are even close on Tapology. I'm going to say over under 80% Pantoja.
That's what I was going to put it at. So I'll say over, I guess.
I think it's going to be a competitive fight. We so have this as a fight of the night. 90% Pantoja out of 1,178 total votes. 51% by decision, 37% by submission. For the 10% that have Perez, 59% by decision. Some change on the finishes, Matt. I think Alessandro Pantoja wins this fight.
So do I.
I don't like the layoff out of Perez. I don't know how it's going to affect him, so take that for what it's worth. And I started the video off not by song quote, but by hopefully we get this fight. But when I look at it for Pantoja, I can't lose you, babe. I don't think he's going to lose.
You just woke up this morning being like, I'm going to sing the weekend in these videos no matter how log-jammed it feels. Here's the thing. Pantoja's way more dangerous and it's not even close. If you're on the mat with him, you're going to get choked out. Like, Brandon Royval's a really good grappler. Like, a really good one. And he didn't even look like he should belong in the grappling department with Pantoja.
Pantoja is the perfect training opponent for Alex Perez and Kyoji Horiguchi at American Top Team.
Yeah, I would agree with that 100%. And for Pantoja, I think he could beat Kai Kara France. He's already beaten Brandon Moreno twice. He didn't arguably beat Askarov, but they fought to a very close fight to where you could make an argument where in a rematch, Pantoja would have a great chance. Like, I look at him as a championship quality fighter. He's had close fights with guys who have held the belt. He's beaten guys who have held the belt. He's just never been able to have sort of the proper matchmaking to get him into that position. And I do feel like this is sort of the UFC giving him one, you know? It's a guy with a long layoff who's had a lot of injuries. There's a lot of question marks about whether or not he can even make the weight class. So I do like Pantoja for all those reasons. I like him stylistically and for a lot of the static surrounding this fight as well.
We're going with the cannibal in this fight.
Wild
Alessandro
nickname.
Pantoja to get the win. And I can't wait for this fight. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Is it the best fighter that's ever come from Dana White's Contender Series, Alex Perez? Or will it be Ultimate Fighter 24's Pantoja? Big fights left on this main card. Derek Lewis taking on Sergey Pavlovich, you're not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Main card, UFC 277. Heavyweights collide. We have the former UFC heavyweight title challenger, the Black Beast, Derek Lewis. The number one knockout artist, not just heavyweight history, UFC history, is Derek Lewis. He's taking on the former Fight Nights Global heavyweight champ, Sergey Pavlovich, a man who wasn't able to get it done in 2018 against one Alistair Overeem. But since then, three big-time wins, some layoffs in between, and his last time out, knocking out old Shamil Abdurakhimov. I'm making it look very easy. So for Pavlovich, this is a guy that I focused on a lot on my Twitter, because I didn't understand why he's in the rankings. Like, if you look at it, he knocks out Maurice Greene, Maurice Greene, 2 years and 8 months ago. And up until about 6 months ago, he's ranked between 11 and 15 in this division. Didn't fight. There were rumblings. There were bookings. He did have three different fights booked. They all fell out due to his own accord or reasons and factors that had to do with him against Ciryl Gane, Tom Aspinall, and Tanner Boser until he fought back early on this year when he knocked out of Abdurakhimov. But when I look at it for Sergey Pavlovich, this is a guy that has one skill. Move forward and beat the daylights out of his opponents. And that's pretty much it for Sergey Pavlovich. I mean, you look at it, strength of schedule, strength of training camp. Obviously, with Fight Nights Global, he was fighting, you know, ghosts of former heavyweights over there with Fight Nights Global.
That's the big thing with Fight Nights Global, and not to harp on this too much, but again, when you look at a lot of their champions, they do bring in some talent who's well-known, but definitely guys who are beatable and expected to lose.
Yeah, I mean, his last win with the belt before he fought Overeem, he had fought baby Fedor Kirill Sedelnikov that really could never get it going, whether it was Bellator or others, but Baga Gaev's a good win from 2016, but you go down through it, you're beating guys you should beat by first round knockout, and Baga Gaev, I guess, by decision. But For Pavlovich, I look at this one, his training camp centered around him but others over across the way. And there's guys like Max Grecian, Alexander Volkov. I threw out another name there. A guy that he trains with is Nikita Krylov as well, that went ham last weekend. But for Pavlovich, move forward. Really big, really long for this division. I mean, you don't need to look at more than the picture to realize that. But 84-inch reach. He seems to use it well. Good pop at the end of his shots. But again, Derek Lewis is one of those guys that can do the old duck under, and that can really mess up. I almost said frig up the style of a guy like Sergei Pavlovich.
Here's my problem with this fight. By every metric, Derek Lewis should win. Like, Sergei Pavlovich doesn't even deserve to be the favorite. He doesn't even deserve to have the odds be anything closer than a plus 200. Because Pavlovich has beaten three guys that Derek Lewis would destroy if he fought at this stage of his career. Shamil Abdurakhimov's not that good anymore. Let's just say it what it is.
Remember when he fought Curtis Blaydes in Abu Dhabi?
And he got taken down more times than anybody had in UFC history and basically gave up. He was so tired in that fight. That's the problem with Pavlovich. He beat the crochet boss, a guy who got dropped by Jean Volante, so we can just stop it right there. Marcelo Gulm, who
hey,
I did not think
he
anything.
He just beat Davion Franklin. Big good. Win.
And where is it? Where did that fight take place?
Bellator,
not in the UFC.
Matter.
Because my thing is, Marcelo Gulm's not here anymore. That tells you how good Marcelo Gulm is. Pavlovich has three wins over guys that, again, Derek Lewis would destroy if he fought them at this stage of his career. I just don't know what stage of Derek Lewis's career he's at right now. Because I said last weekend how weird it was after Robbie Lawler was champion to see him be like the 11th ranked welterweight in the division. It just didn't make any sense to my brain. This guy was either ranked number one or champion for as long as I had followed MMA. Derek Lewis is in that category at this stage where he's fought pretty much everybody in the top five. He's beat some of them, lost to a lot of them, and now we just don't really know where he sits in the whole entire division. To me, this fight comes down to just overall motivation more than anything, because if this is Derek Lewis with 1 foot out, who might have a lot of injuries throughout his career, which is the truth, like, I was listening to a Bill Simmons podcast a little while ago, and they were talking about Paul George, and he was like, I'd hate to do an MRI of Paul George's body, just because of all the injuries he's had, it would light up like a Christmas tree. Derek Lewis is in the same camp. He tore his ACL against Junior Dos Santos. He's had more back issues than I can count at this stage of his career, and his last fight against Tai Tuivasa, he looked terrible and unmotivated.
And the trouble for me is, for Derek Lewis, so I went back in my mind, because I remember after the Ciryl Gane fight, he said, you know what, the pressure, it's in Houston, this and that. Derek Lewis before Ciryl Gane was 10-0 fighting in Texas.
I know, I said it was really bad that he lost a hometown fight, and you said it was stupid for saying that.
And so he loses in Houston, be that what it may. He gets his win sandwiched between his two losses here against Chris Daukaus. And then he loses against Tai Tuivasa. Again, that fight was also in Houston. So he's lost his last two in Houston. He has one fight in Dallas, and he won that fight. So this is his second fight career in Dallas. He's what now? 10-2 fighting at home in Texas. But I look at this fight, yeah, Derek Lewis against Tai Tuivasa didn't look all that great, got backed up. Sergei Pavlovich
to Tuivasa early though,
for sure. And you know, they got in tight range, obviously behind the black line up by the cage. This is going to be in Dallas, so again, big cage, big heavyweights, a little bit different than the smaller cage at you know, the UFC's Apex. Pavlovich is one of those guys that fights behind his length. Yes, he's tall. Yes, he has a propensity to lean back. So Derek Lewis could clip him, as we always know with every Derek Lewis fight. But you look at the odds in this one. Lewis open minus 115, minus 106 for Pavlovich. Open minus 105, minus 116. So the odds have basically flipped. Topology votes, Matt. They're surprised to us. They are to you. Derek Lewis, most knockouts UFC history. I'm going to say over under 60% Lewis.
I think it'll be like 75% Lewis, to be honest. He's pretty famous.
1,297 total votes. 51% Pavlovich, 84% by knockout. For the 49% that have Derek Lewis, 88% by knockout. The fans say knockout. 51% have Pavlovich, Matt. Who do you have?
It is going to end in knockout. I feel very comfortable making that statement. Derek Lewis got knocked out by Sean Jordan from a hook kick, okay? Sergei Pavlovich has beaten guys who are no longer in the UFC, and that tells you all you need to know about this fight. Like, again,
Fight doesn't go decision. One side has it minus 600.
Yeah, it's not like a hot take by me saying that. Just, like, I couldn't imagine the carnage that would happen if Derek Lewis fought Marcelo Gulm. I couldn't imagine what would happen if Derek Lewis fought even Shamil Abdurakhimov at this stage of his career. Like, Sergei Pavlovich has beaten guys that I fully expect him to beat the whole entire time he was in the UFC, and he lost the one time I expected him to lose in a very, very difficult debut against Alistair Overeem, who did show that wrinkle of his game that we don't often see. We saw the grappling side of Alistair Overeem. Here's the other X factor we haven't talked about yet. Derek Lewis is kind of underrated as a wrestler. I know no one likes to admit it. I know it's not a sexy thing to say. Everybody likes the knockout punches, but he's got a pretty good double leg when he does shoot for it across the cage. He's very explosive with that one technique. And I gotta be honest, if there's ever a time where Derek Lewis is gonna shoot for a takedown, it's probably gonna be this matchup against Sergey Pavlovich. I hate that I'm ever so slightly favoring Derek Lewis for a wrestling edge that I perceive that he will have in this matchup, but I would much rather pick the guy who has lost to great fighters than somebody who's looked good at beating the fighters that I always expect him to beat in the first place. I thought Derek Lewis is going to beat Tai Tuivasa. He wasn't able to, but I think Tai Tuivasa's looked pretty good ever since he came back to the UFC. He never really got cut in the first place. It was a weird situation anyways, but still, I think Tai Tuivasa has made a big evolution in his game, and I think a lot of people are falling into recency bias with this. They're looking at Derek Lewis and how poor he looked in his last performance. They're looking at how good Pavlovich has looked throughout his past few fights, and I think they're putting a lot more stock into Pavlovich beating guys who, again, he was fully expected to beat in all those matchups.
So are you throwing shade at anybody that takes Pavlovich?
No. All my
points.
Sounds
like it.
I just don't think you can make a solid argument from Pavlovich without any... He beat three guys that Derek Lewis would absolutely run through. He has not fought anybody on the level that Derek Lewis has fought. So I think it's very hard for anybody to sit down and say, hey, I think Sergey Pavlovich is going to win, because Derek Lewis has fought guys who fight in a very similar manner to him, and he's been able to stop a lot of those guys. So other than motivation, I do like Derek Lewis in this fight. He could show up flat because he does every now and then, but if you just look at both guys technically, well, Derek Lewis is the better striker. He's more heavy-handed. I even think he has the faster hands too. So I do like Derek Lewis, but again, I don't like it when I have to question a fighter's mindset, because that is a very big key to the fight. But skill for skill, I do like Lewis in this fight.
I think Pavlovich is faster, longer. I think he knocks out Derek Lewis in Texas.
Well, he could, but again, he's only beaten guys that everybody thought he was going to beat. Derek Lewis has fought some of the best fighters in the world. So again, Lewis has been in there with some all-time greats. He just knocked out Curtis Blaydes not that long ago. Like, he really does have an advanced skill set to face some of these top-tier heavyweights. I just don't think Pavlovich is on that level.
Yeah, I think he's been knocking out guys that he should in ways that he should, and for those reasons, I happen to beat Derek Lewis. Again, length, pop at the end of his shots, you back up Derek Lewis. Again, you get him behind the black line, you either get two things. You get him back up against the cage, waiting, or, excuse me, he's able to land that big-time shot and finish a guy. So, for those reasons, we're split on the pick. I'm going with Russia's Sergey Pavlovich to get the win. You have the home state guy in Derek Lewis.
He is a Rockets fan, though, so maybe he's not happy with fighting in the Dallas Mavericks arena.
Maybe that's true. We'll see what happens with Lewis. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. This is going to be an entertaining one because it's on the pay-per-view portion of the card, and we have the Sidekick Live with the channel. So we really want to hear your thoughts, whether it's on the live show or here below in the comments section. Two title fights up at the top. Co-main and main event in rematches. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Co-main event coming up this weekend, UFC 277. A rematch in the first fight back in December of 2019 saw Brandon Moreno win a decision against Kai Kara-France in a fight where Kara-France was the favorite. And coming up this weekend, Brandon Moreno now the favorite by the tune of, well, basically, it's a flip-flop of the odds. We have an interesting one with Brandon Moreno coming off of a non-successful title defense. Gave up the belt in the third fight, the trilogy against Deiveson Figueiredo. And if you look at it for Kai Kara-France, he's riding a wave of success. Three-fight win streak, beat Askar Askarov his last time out. Everybody remembers the Cody Garbrandt knockout. You saw the reaction here on the channel. And that's one of those ones that I see a lot of Fight Night Picks fans out there, and we're going to get to you folks because we throw these out there, the YouTube community tab every week. We want your votes, but we also want to hear from you so we can feature it in the video. Your say counts here, so we want you to join in the action. But a lot of people talking about Kai Kara-France and the fact that he's only as good as that Garbrandt knockout, and that Garbrandt knockout doesn't account for much.
It's definitely his highest profile win up until this point. I know Askarov is probably the better fighter at 125, but the fight with the most eyeballs on it was definitely the Cody Garbrandt fight. But I do sort of agree with some of those people who discredit that win, because let's be honest, Cody Garbrandt did not have a very good chin at 135 pounds, so what did everybody think was going to happen when he moved down to 125? We all kind of said his chin was going to get worse, and it did get worse. Now, You can't take it. It's not Kai Kara France's fault that Cody Garbrandt didn't look good in that fight. Like, he did exactly what he was supposed to do, and that's why it was nice that they gave him the Askarov win, or sorry, the fight right after that one, because it allowed him to prove, okay, I am this good against the top-tier talent in my division, too. I don't have to fight a guy with all these oh-by-the-ways attached to him, and the first fight between these guys was incredible. It was a very competitive fight back and forth, where Kai Kara France had a lot of success early on in the fight with his boxing combos. He was a lot faster, too, with his hands, interestingly enough, on the inside, but as the fight went on, Brandon Moreno got a lot more aggressive as that fight went on. In the third round, he's throwing combos followed by head kicks, yelling at Kai Kara France, like really marching him down and chasing him in that third round, to where Moreno, not that he 10-8'd him, but it was one of those rounds where it was like, oh wow, like the fight was close, it was two close rounds, and then a definite Brandon Moreno round to end it, and that's why it was such a close fight. I know a lot of people who thought, hey, there's a chance, or there's an area or a world where Kai Kara France won that fight. I disagree ever so slightly. There can be close fights without there being robberies, but it was a very close fight. And if it was that good for 15 minutes, I can't wait to see these guys fight for 25, because Moreno is one of the greatest chins of all time, sort of the best cardio of all time, and Kai Kara France has shown to be one of the most well-rounded guys in this division and one of the most heavy-handed strikers, so this is one of those fight-of-the-night fights without a doubt.
And for Kai Kara France, first opportunity at a five-round fight in the UFC. We'll have to see how the team at City Kickboxing with Eugene Behrman's able to get him ready for a fight like this, but you look at the losses in the UFC. I mean, Brandon Moreno, Brandon Royval, the Brandons have his number, so another opportunity for Moreno here. But you go through the overall career, and there were so many names that you recognize on Kai Kara France's record before coming into the UFC. Now, maybe they were off of losses, like Denis Bakary, Mark Striegel. There was Pantoja on The Ultimate Fighter, Tatsumitsu Wada over with Ryzen. But you look at the wins, and I mean, especially coming into the UFC, Elias Garcia, Haulian Paiva, Mark De La Rosa, Tyson Nam, Rogerio Bontorin.
Wild fight.
A knock-em-out, drag-em-out, first-round fight of the night style. Knocks out Garbrandt, beats Askarov. In a fight that's relatively contentious, you can make an argument either way. I thought Kai Kara France won two of those rounds, but I'm here to listen to your argument. But again, for Moreno, you touch on just kind of the run that he's gone on since he got cut off the Pantoja loss. Wins the flyweight belt against Michael Perez over with LFA. Comes back to the UFC, has the draw against Askarov. Whether you thought Moreno won or not, it was a close fight. But then he goes on that run. Kai Kara France, UCA Formiga, finishes Brandon Royval, and it was kind of gross the way that that one ended. You don't want to see a fight end that way. But then the draw against Figueiredo, the win, the finish against Figueiredo, and then the loss by decision. It'll be interesting to see. You know, we talk about motivation, we talk about this and that with fighters, and I never like to question it, but the only thing I have is, why specifically changing camps to Glory MMA and Fitness and working with James Krause and some of the training partners that are over there instead of Entram Gym to get ready for some of these different fights, especially the fight against Kai Kara France? Because I would think for Moreno, you're going to go there, the heart of America, to work your wrestling to fight against a very good striker.
I don't want to say we had inside information, but we did talk to him when he was on the Marcus Deegan show. You know what he said during that show? I'm going to move to America. I'm going to train in America. This isn't some big secret if you have been following along. So for Brandon Moreno, I don't think this is just one spur-of-the-moment camp change where it's like, hey, I lost my last fight. I need to make a wholesale change. I really do feel like in this matchup against Kai Kara France, we will see that wrestling side of him a lot more.
Okay, that was my question. What's your why?
What's my why? That's a very deep question. But no, for Brandon Moreno, he is trying to get back to become a title. He had one of the greatest rivalries this division's ever known, and he's arguably one of the best fighters in this division in this era. Now, of course, Mighty Mouse is always going to be the GOAT at this division. It's almost going to be impossible for anybody to replace him, because in hindsight, some of his numbers look like Wilt Chamberlain's numbers from like the 62 season. You're like, wait, he averaged 48 and a half minutes a game? Aren't games only 48 minutes long? Like, some of those stats don't make any sense.
Like,
but
the stats on the court or in the bedroom?
Listen, they both get pretty legendary. But that's the thing about Brandon Moreno. These guys had a very close three-round fight where Brandon Moreno got a lot stronger as that fight went on. I've been quoted as saying multiple times that if fights were in five rounds and the fights just never ended, Brandon Moreno would be undefeated. Like, his cardio, his output is legendary stuff. And I know he has eaten a lot of big shots, especially in that last three fights or in those last three fights against Deiveson Figueiredo. But that's the thing. If you fight Figueiredo for like 90 minutes combined, you're probably going to get hit by some big shots along the way. And in the third fight, it was interesting because, okay, they fought to a very close one the first time around. It was a draw, but Figueiredo won. He just lost the point. Moreno came out like an absolute demon the second time, looked as good as he has ever looked throughout his career. And in the third fight, it was very back and forth, but Moreno got dropped a few times by some really big shots from Figueiredo, and those were the difference in the matchup. The thing is, Figueiredo can carry his power late into fights. He is one of those one-of-one kind of unicorns, if you will, to where most power punchers do not carry their power late in fights. And in that fight, I vividly remember Figueiredo looking really tired. And you're like, oh my goodness, is Moreno going to pour it on now? And then when he needed to land that one big shot, he was able to do it. He just sort of has that innate ability to be able to rally back into fights when he has to. I don't know if Kai Kara-France is cut from that same cloth. I know he can get down bad in the first part of a fight and then rally through. I don't question his heart by any means in that capacity, but when you look at how Brandon Moreno lost to Deiveson Figueiredo, it was okay. We're fighting at a crazy all-time pace, and then I'm getting hit by some big shots because this power puncher just so happens to be able to keep up this pace with me. I think Kai Kara-France can make this fight very interesting early on. I even think it can hurt Brandon Moreno. But let's say Moreno does utilize his grappling like we know that he can. I even think back to the early goings of the Sergio Pettis fight before he got caught from the UFC. He spent 5.5 minutes in a row on Sergio Pettis's back. Now, yes, he wasn't able to finish the submission, but just getting to a position that dominant on a fighter that skilled is a big feather in Brandon Moreno's cap. And even the Askar Askarov fight, I know it was a draw, but Brandon Moreno grappled Askar Askarov for a lot of that matchup. And I think both those guys are a whole heck of a lot better at grappling than Kai Kara-France.
You make the comparison between Moreno and the fight against Sergio Pettis. I mean, look at Aljamain Sterling against Piotr Jan. Submit him, but he was able to take the back and do a lot with it. So if you look at Fight Name Picks, we throw it on over to you in the YouTube community tab. 1,300 votes in 9 hours, so kudos to you. That's more than you're going to find on Topology right now. 59% going with the former champ Moreno, 41% Kai Kara-France. Going into the comments, that can get a little... It can turn into a doozy, but stocks on deck. This is a completely different Kai. A Kai who's been soaking up the knowledge of two perennial champions in Volk. And is he expecting a lights-out performance from Kai Kara-France? We got Bill saying this fight already happened in 2019. Can't see the result being different since it was so recent. Wild Hogs got to go Moreno. Be Kai's first time fighting in a 5-round fight. And I'll go one more. Jack Green saying Moreno... 49-46 or a finish in round 3 for Moreno. So a lot of people going through it. A lot of people talking Moreno and Kai Kara-France. We have a look at the odds in this one. Moreno open minus 160, minus 207 right now. Kai Kara-France open at plus 140. Excuse me. Kai Kara-France open at plus 140. He's now at a plus 170. And in their first matchup, Kai Kara-France was the favorite, Moreno at a plus 135. So interesting to see the odds shift, but obviously we understand why.
One guy did become champ. After.
One guy became the champion and a bit of a face of the franchise for a little bit, and then he kind of had to play a lesser role as it goes on. But when you do look at this fight, Kai Kara-France with his power and just his overall output, like this guy is hard to slow down. But again, we haven't seen it over 5 rounds. So I'm interested to see if he can keep that pace throughout a 5-round fight.
Exactly. It's just the unknown, and that's the issue. Like, Kai Kara-France could look really good in the 4th and 5th round. I can give you that. I know Brandon Moreno looks really good in the 4th and 5th round, and I know that he gets stronger in the 4th and 5th round, and that's what I do think is the key. Moreno had an issue with his cardio in the early goings of his UFC career. It got him hurt against Pantoja, got him hurt against Sergio Pettis in their 5-round fight. He has more than been able to fix that throughout his championship run. He has learned a lot of lessons from those Deiveson Figueiredo wars that he went through, and I do feel like he still is an improved fighter, even though he did lose his last fight against Figueiredo. It's just, when you have two all-time greats fighting each other, you're going to win some, you're going to lose some. Think about Larry Bird, Magic Johnson in the 80s. Like, they're both all-time greats. Sometimes one's going to win. Sometimes the other's going to win. So I do like Brandon Moreno for the reason that I brought up earlier. I like the fact that he was able to rally in that third round because that's a big key. If Kara-France does start to slow in the third round and you give Moreno the chance to even just win the third, fourth, and fifth, he more than has that capacity to be able to do that. So even if Kara-France wins the first 2 rounds, I still think there's a great chance Moreno can rally back in the third, fourth, and fifth. And that's with basically everything going in Kara-France's way in the early goings of this matchup. So I do like Brandon Moreno in this fight, but I think it's going to be an incredible one.
I like the takedown ability of Brandon Moreno. I think accentuating that at Glory MMA and Fitness, whatever you make of James Krause, it's the people in the room that are going to help out with that aspect of his game, maybe more so than the fighters at Entram gyms, though I would say Johnny Munoz Jr. is probably a good guy to work that with at that gym.
The way I look at Brandon Moreno, though, changing gyms, it's very similar to Kamaru Usman going from Sanford MMA to Elevation. It's like, okay, you're at a really good gym, you have all these good training partners, they got you to a title, why are you changing gyms now? For Usman, it it was, hey, I've just been with these guys for a long time. I still have a great relationship with all of them. Him and Gilbert Burns are still good friends. But he had to go have a different look, train with some new people, and it added an aspect to his game that we never thought we'd see. I can see the same thing from Brandon Moreno, who's a championship quality fighter who has now changed gyms to a very good gym. I think just the fact that he's in there with new guys is going to be a very refreshing sight for Brandon Moreno, and I think we could see an even more improved version of Moreno this weekend.
The scrambling abilities of Kai Kara-France can't be denied, and this is a guy that good takedown defense, good at getting away from the pressure, and good at dishing out even if he's on the back foot. So I do like Brandon Moreno. To me, it's a championship experience paired with every aspect of his game, but I'm always a little bit leery of a guy coming off a title loss. It's one of those ones that you just sit in the back of your head and wonder, hey, are the wheels going to fall off? Did we age overnight? How will it play out? So both of us in this one going with Mexico's assassin baby Brandon Moreno to get the interim belt to fight Deiveson Figueiredo for a fourth time.
I'm here. I've watched those guys fight 9 times. Like, I don't care how many times Moreno and Figueiredo get paired up for the title. Just give it to us, UFC. Like, there's so many of these gatekeepers who are the number one contenders right now that it makes me sick. Because, like, in middleweight, okay, I don't care who fights Israel Adesanya at this point. You know why? Because they've all lost to Robert Whittaker, too. And I know Izzy's quite a bit better than Whittaker. If Moreno finds himself in that perennial number one contender spot, just give him the title fight. Like, I think everybody would watch Figueiredo versus Moreno 11 times if they had to, because those guys' styles are tailor-made for an amazing fight no matter how many times they go in there and fight.
Should be a lot of fun. Again, both of us with Moreno in this matchup. You let us know, as you always do, community tab down here in the old comment section, who you have. No wrong answers until Saturday night, and be sure to check in with our sidekicks here on the channel. We're going to be live during the main card. You can hang out, you can hit up the chat, and we can watch some fights. It should be a great time. Main event rematch as well for the bantamweight strap. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it live in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Bantamweight title on the line between the bantamweight champ Juliana Pena, the Venezuelan vixen. She's taking on the lioness Amanda Nunes. Still featherweight champ, if there's UFC featherweights that exist. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. As always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FMP. With me to my left, to your right, as always, Matt Allen, respective socials, at Matt Allen FMP. Now, this is a rematch like we have in the co-main event. Brandon Moreno taking on Kai Kara-France. First fight, Brandon Moreno wins. Somewhat of a controversial decision, but a very fun fight. It should be a great fight. In this main event, Amanda Nunes, greatest women's fighter of all time?
Easily.
Right up there on the Mount Rushmore of women's MMA with, like, Chris Cyborg and Ronda Rousey and name your other one, Holly Holm, Misha Tate, whoever you want to pick. Taking on Juliana Pena, somebody that nobody gave a shot to as being Amanda Nunes. I didn't either. There are limited amounts of people that thought that she had a chance, but what she did was she just withstood the punishment. And once Amanda Nunes really started to kind of teeter off and give up the striking defense and the rest of it, when the wheels fell off, Juliana Pena was there to finish the fight. Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, trains out of Valley Flow striking, and she's also from the Pacific Northwest originally. Now, for Juliana Pena, things have blown up since she's become the champion, and I'm the king of prop comedy. I'm like the Carrot Top of Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada.
I would never declare myself king of anything. I can't believe you just said that.
But the reason, no, I have a reason for this one. So, UFC in 2021, greatest women's fighter of all time, they come out with Panini Prism cards. And if you can see this, I'm going to put it right there. You can see the fighters on the cover. So you have Khabib Nurmagomedov, Jorge Masvidal, Amanda Nunes, and John Jones. Well, one's retired, one's in some hot water, one's only one of the two.
And the other one lives in hot water.
Yeah. John Jones only lives in hot tubs. Now, on the cover of the new Donruss cards, Kamaru Usman, Juliana Pena, Khamzat Chimaev, and Jorge Masvidal. So, hot water man's still there. But the point I have to make is Amanda Nunes, not featured in as many promo materials as she once was. And Juliana Pena, it's not just an example from a box of cards in one fight that she won about 6 months ago. She has gone leaps and bounds into stardom as a UFC bantamweight champ, and I just wanted to start it off there.
And it's been really nice to see, because there's a lot of fighters in these not-as-publicized weight classes who, they get the belt, and nothing really changes with them. So it has been really nice to see Juliana Pena take full advantage of the opportunity that she's been given. And good on her. She speaks incredibly well for a UFC champion. She is very marketable with her own personality, because Juliana Pena is just like any one of us. You know what I mean? Like, there's nothing that really separates her from the average person. That's what makes her really cool. She's a mom, too. So that's all really cool from Juliana Pena. This is my big issue with this fight. We saw Amanda Nunes basically give up. And I'm going to say basically because I'm not in her mind, so I don't know exactly what her thought process was. But I always go back to when Volkanovski fought Brian Ortega. Brian Ortega is the greatest jiu-jitsu ace we've ever seen in the smaller weight classes. And he put in two of his best submissions against the world champion. What did Alexander Volkanovski do? He let his body go pale and his head go purple and didn't give up. The second Amanda Nunes started to bend, she broke in their last matchup against Juliana Pena. And it's really interesting to think about the motivation of fighters, and this is very much a boxing mindset to bring over to MMA. But you guys know I'm a big boxing fan too. In boxing, we see it a lot, where someone will lose a high-profile fight and immediately fire everybody and change coaches, and they're never the same afterwards. Where's Amanda Nunes trained now, Craig?
I put the Lioness Studio, but it's her own gym.
Exactly. It's no longer American Top Team, a gym known for having killers all over in every weight class
Former
of every gender.
American Top Team coaches, though, that are there.
I know. I'm just saying the quality of training partner is not going to be what
it
once was.
She's bringing people to match her skills.
I'm sure she has been able to, but again, I never like it when someone makes a panic change at 32 years old, because 34, sorry, again, she was a fighter who had the recipe. She was the greatest ever, and then she suffered a bad loss, and now it's time to make all these changes. It just feels like it's very spur of the moment from Amanda Nunes, and we have seen this happen to many combat sports athletes before. Deontay Wilder's my favorite boxer of all time. What did Wilder do after his second fight against Tyson Fury? Fired everybody and got a new training camp. Now, to be fair, he looked pretty good in the trilogy before he got stopped, but still, I just don't like it when you see an all-time great make these massive changes to their camp based off one loss. If it was like, hey, Amanda Nunes has been sort of weaning off American Top Team, she's always been thinking about this, it'd be one thing, but it does feel all very sudden to her, and I'm just very curious to see if it is going to give a new version of her, or if we're just going to see a similar Amanda Nunes who might be a little bit more focused.
What happened to Jan Blachowicz after he lost to Glover Teixeira?
I mean, he's looked okay.
But he won a fight, correct?
He did, yeah.
Yeah, and
based off an injury, though.
Charles Oliveira was of the camp of quitter, and now he's one of the greatest lightweights of all time.
No, but these people were not champions to begin with. Charles Oliveira was a middle-of-the-road lightweight who nobody cared about before he then got focused. Jan Blachowicz beat a guy by injury his last time out, so I don't know if those examples
he
are great.
He still looked fine in the cage, though, and he didn't lose.
Okay, but that's not telling the full story if you just say it like that. That's all.
I don't really like the argument. So around Nunes, though, she has left American Top Team. That is a big topic of conversation. Now, again, there are UFC and ATT adjacent folks training with her. Obviously, it was a point that I had to make before Garrett Armfield came in on day's notice to fight David Onama. You had Armfield over there training with the Lioness. But you look at it for Juliana Pena on the counter. Still at Valley Flow Striking System, so you do like to see that out of her, the consistency. Obviously, the Ultimate Fighter. It's weird when the coaches fight before the season's over, but you do have the season finishing after, so Thiago Santos got a big-time main event coming up, and under that, you have the Ultimate Fighter, so...
And I haven't watched a single Ultimate Fighter fight yet, I gotta be honest. I do not care about Tough at all at this point.
But we will, so get ready for that. But when it does come down to this one, obviously the knock on both of these fighters, Amanda Nunes, nobody was on that level. And then finally Juliana Pena offered up a lot of resistance, and Nunes wasn't able to get over the hump. And for Juliana Pena, the opposite is true, because Build is a great Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. Build is a great grappler. Got one arm submitted by Jermaine Durandamy, kickboxer.
And got submitted by Valentina off her back.
Like, it's just wishy-washy. And obviously for Pena, the layoffs, that has been a big topic of conversation as well. But again, the nice two-fight win streak. Kind of weird when you beat Sarah McMahon to get your title shot, you know, in the not-so-distant past. But yeah, it's just, it is an oddball rematch. And it's an odd spot that we're in because Juliana Pena, if we want to call her the Buster Douglas to the Mike Tyson, it's just, it is such a shock champion in this circumstance.
This is the thing about Amanda Nunes, though. Leading up to the Ronda Rousey fight, nobody cared about Amanda Nunes because they only promoted Ronda Rousey throughout that whole time. They thought, hey, our Golden Goose is going to win, so let's not worry about anybody else. That really backfired on them. But what was the story about Ronda Rousey after she lost to Holly Holm? Is that she doesn't have the motivation she once does. She made a lot more money in MMA. She made a lot of money outside MMA. She's probably not the same person that she once was. Amanda Nunes hasn't had the same level of success outside of the UFC that a Ronda Rousey does, but you can follow a very similar career path to how Amanda Nunes lost her title the last time out. This is a big hot take when I made it, but like, one of the biggest underdogs I've ever predicted was that Amanda Nunes is going to wash Chris Cyborg. I said that before that fight happened. I said Chris Cyborg has beaten a bunch of women she's supposed to beat her whole entire career, and this is the first woman who actually poses a serious threat to her in a number of years. And what happened? Amanda Nunes went out there, made the fight hard early, and Chris Cyborg was not really ready for that because she hadn't been in a fight like that for a very long time. I think Amanda Nunes found herself in the exact same position that two of her own biggest wins were. She had gotten a lot more famous since the first fight, since she had become a champion. She's enjoyed a lot of the success of MMA, and I just don't think she is the motivated champion that she once was. When you're in the back of the race, you're constantly looking at the person who's in first, trying to catch up to them, looking for something new to accomplish. Amanda Nunes has led the race for years and years and years and years, and if you're not looking behind you because nobody's that close to you, then you're never worried about anybody catching up. And I think at this point, it's not that Juliana Pena's skill set is some great counter to Amanda Nunes, but she's got good wrestling. That's the only thing that Amanda Nunes isn't top tier in, because we all know how good her jiu-jitsu is. We all know how good her boxing is. Like, those things are undeniable. She's arguably the best in the division at both of those. But her cardio, I would say, is slightly suspect. Again, people like to bring up the Katsingano fight. It was a very, very long time ago, so I have to say that. But her one weakness against Juliana Pena that definitely showed was her cardio, and I think that's where that submission loss really came down to. It was how dedicated was Amanda Nunes to that fight. Did she almost buy into her own hype? Like, I think there's a world where Amanda Nunes looks 30, 40% better in this fight because it was okay. I had the bad loss. Maybe that was the reset that she needed to really get back on track.
And it really is tough. I mean, at 34, are we at the end? Are we getting close? Like, where exactly are we? We throw it on over to the YouTube community tab. 2,000 votes, 63% with Nunes and 37% with Juliana Pena. We have a look at some of the comments. Chad, the UFC dad, Juliana gets it done with a strong jab cardio. Mental edge ain't going to be easy, but she ready. Northwest stand up. Tommy saying, Juliana shocks the world again. Hashtag and still. We've got Carnage 29. As long as Nunes respects Pena, she's got this. And one more, we spamming, saying, if Nunes loses to her again, then I'm throwing out my TV out the window this time. So, yeah, I'd say probably not along. Mine's attached to the wall, but if we got it down somehow, I don't get that involved. But we look at the odds in this one. Nunes open minus 250, minus 287. We have a look at Pena, plus 210 to plus 229. So Nunes has gained on the line. Obviously, the gym switch, this and that. When I break this one down to X's and O's, Nunes had a good first round against Pena.
She did.
And stop...
Fell off a cliff.
Stop respecting the striking of Juliana Pena. She was, like, smiling in those striking exchanges to where she kept getting hit with the jab in the right hand. And then eventually, once it hit the mat, that was all she wrote and it was over. And we're in this state of shock, like when Maria Agapova lost to Shanna Dobson. Like, big time shock. Like, I'm thinking Matt Serra beating GSP, making him tap the strikes. Now, GSP came back and won the next fight. So... it is what
GSP
it is.
GSP was like 24, though.
But when I look at this fight, for Pena, peaked at 32, almost 33. Amanda Nunes just turned 34 a couple of months ago. You sound like you've leaned one way.
This is my problem. Juliana Pena winning the title was very similar to when the Warriors won the title, but also had the worst loss in playoff history to the Memphis Grizzlies when they didn't have John Morant. It's like, wait, you got submitted by a pure striker who can't grapple to save her life. But then you also out-grapple, like, one of the greatest fighters I've ever seen. Like, nothing about this fight makes sense whatsoever. But again, I'm sticking with everything I said about Amanda Nunes earlier on in the video. I know it's not a lot of head shaking to my right, but I do worry about where her motivation is at this stage of her career. I think there's a world where she looks a lot better. I think there's a world where she looks a lot worse, too. Because, again, once people figure out your weaknesses in MMA, they go back to that well over and over and over again. Think about Anthony Pettis. Anthony Pettis was unbeatable. Clay Guida beat him, but other than that, he was pretty much unbeatable. And then Rafael Dos Anjos fought him, and everybody looked at that fight and said, hey, I can throw straight shots down the middle and panic take down Anthony Pettis. Like, it's not that hard to do. And guess what? Everybody from that stage forward in his career has followed the exact same game plan against Anthony Pettis. Sometimes he's won, sometimes he's lost, but he's never been the Showtime that he once was after he got exposed. I think Amanda Nunes is going to win this fight, but this is what I will say. What? I said she's the more talented. I just don't know where her motivation is. That's really the key. I don't like a lot of the signs from Amanda Nunes, but she is still technically better in most areas of the fight. The thing about the smiling, though, is Amanda Nunes smiles in all of her fights no matter what. Like, she's beating the brakes off people. She always just has that facial expression. I wouldn't look too much into that, but I do think her cardio is going to be the big X factor. Listen, if Juliana Pena shoots for a lot of takedowns, maybe can't get them, but just doesn't eat a lot of damage to her head, those are all going to be winning exchanges for Juliana Pena, and I do expect that position to happen a lot in this fight. I don't think this is going to win fight of the night because, again, I think Pena is going to have to be very dedicated to her clinch control and her wrestling, but I think on the in-betweens, Nunes will be able to damage her enough to be able to edge on the judges' scorecards, but I'm going to look at this fight very similar to, like, a Shevchenko versus Talia Santos. I think by the end of it, it's going to be a really close and highly contested fight.
And it's going to be an interesting one, too. Obviously, for Juliana Pena, submission artists, submission losses for Amanda Nunes, the early roadblocks on the way up through the UFC to the giant win streak. And if you look at this fight and you consider Amanda Amanda Nunes, kind of like the Bare Naked Ladies song. I'm the kind of guy that laughs at a funeral. It just gets weird when she's smiling in the striking exchanges. You wonder, hey, are you wild? Like, are you crazy? And apparently she is. But when I do look at this fight overall, I look at the successes that not just Amanda Nunes has had against the Chris Cyborgs, the Megan Andersons, the Felicia Spencers. I mean, fighters that she's supposed to beat. When I look at a fight against Juliana Pena,
she was plus like 500 against Cyborg. She wasn't supposed to beat her.
Obviously, you look at Amanda Nunes in these fights that she has won, the successes that she's had, and in the Jermaine Duranemi fight, the point that people kind of, or the thing that people point to is, well, she wasn't as successful with the takedown. She spent a little bit of time off for back.
Got lit up on the feet.
Jermaine Duranemi was able to have some success in the striking. When I look at a fight between Nunes and Pena, I'm still left with the same feeling of Amanda Nunes, if we rank them, Hall of Fame badge with the striking. When it comes to the wrestling defense, we're starting to get like bronze maybe. Like if we're thinking NBA 2K, like we're not the worst, we're not the best. But you can definitely see Pena exploiting that once more. But to get there, she had to utilize her striking to beat Nunes, and I don't see that happening the second time around.
I do think she's the steady. Again, fatigue makes cowards out of everybody. It's the truth. Like, I don't care how skilled you are. If you get tired, none of your skills matter. So again, the big X factor is, if Nunes looks like prime Nunes, I don't think this fight's very competitive. We just don't know if Nunes is still in her prime at this point. Like, she got started in her MMA very early, which normally means your prime ends very early too. So I'm very curious to see what version of Nunes we do get this weekend, because I think there's a world where she looks 30% better than their first fight. I think there's a world where she looks 30% worse than their first fight, but I'm still gonna pick her.
I think we're gonna get a late stage Jose Aldo performance out of Amanda Nunes, and we're going to get a return to greatness taking on Juliana Pena. But again, listen, one used to be on the Wheaties box, the UFC prism. She's no longer there, and Juliana Pena is that poster child. So big opportunity for both these women in the rematch for the bantamweight strap. Two title fights, don't forget that. Brandon Moreno taking on Kai Kara France in their rematch, interim flyweight gold. You got a card littered with good fights. Question mark kicks 2 hours before the prelims. The Ultimate Fighter 30 finale coming up in a few weeks, and then you also have the sidekick during this main card for the pay-per-view. We're live here on YouTube, and if you missed it, Dana White's Contender Series. You folks subscribed, you supported the channel, and all thanks to you, we're throwing those videos out there. Mondays, you can check them out. It should be a lot of fun with the season kicking off this week, and if you're watching this fight after Tuesday, forget about it. We'll be back for next week. So a lot of great fights. Hopefully everybody enjoys it and has a good week.
Yeah, it should be a great pay-per-view. I'm really excited for it, and hopefully you guys are too.
Should be a lot of fun. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, and as we always say,
let's get into it.